The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to an in-depth, original investigative report on the subject of the case against Dr. Wakefield, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, and some associates involved in a series of clinical observations, a scientific report published in the peer-reviewed journal The Lancet, subsequent attacks against Dr. Wakefield and the other scientists by one John Deere, an investigative journalist in England, and then the British Medical Journal's retraction and condemnation of Dr. Wakefield, and the American media siding completely with John Deere. As it stands now, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who will be on this program today, who is an academic gastroenterologist specializing in inflammatory bowel disease and the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, the MMR vaccine, is formerly a member fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons. He has published more than 130 original scientific papers. In 1998, he and his colleagues at the Royal Free Hospital in London reported a novel inflammatory bowel disease in children with developmental disorders such as autism. Dr. Wakefield resisted pressure to stop his investigations into a possible link between the vaccines, intestinal inflammation, and autism. He left the hospital in 2001 to further pursue his research into neurological injury to children and its possible relationship to environmental causes such as immunizations. In 2001, he was awarded the fellowship of the Royal College of Pathologists, and he is a medical advisor, was to the British charity Visceral, and a board member of the American Charity of the Medical Interventions for Autism. Dr. Wakefield lost his job at the Royal Free Hospital and his career medical license as well. The timing of the release of this report, the timing of the release of all of this, raises suspicions. Our investigation will ask the following questions. Is Dr. Andrew Wakefield guilty of fraud, medical fraud? Is he the person that we should be focusing our interest in? This special 2 or even 3 hour investigation today will explore these in details. This is an extremely complex issue. I will be interweaving multiple facts together. In order not to make this seem or sound arcane, I have tried to simplify everything. But at the end of the day, if I say something, if Wakefield or any of the other panels say something, and Brian Deere said something, or the British Medical Journal published something, how do we know who to believe? Therefore, it is based upon authentic documentation. What can be actually proven? And proven in ways that the information is objective. First, the larger issue, a timeline, so it won't be confusing to people. In 1995, Rosemary Cassick sought out Dr. Andrew Wakefield to find out what happened to her son. Her son was sick, and none of the other physicians that she was seeing seemed to know what the causes were or how to treat them. In 1995 to 96, Andrew Wakefield researches literature to investigate the possibilities, initially thinking some form of disintegrative disorder. In September 1996, the first child of a series of children admitted for clinical investigations and biopsies covered by a 1995 ethics approval were given. Then, from the 2nd to the 16th of September 1996, the first 4 of 12 children being seen on clinical need, and by the way, that was done at the Royal Free Hospital, a very prestigious institution, much like our MD Anderson or Sloan Kettering or Columbia Presbyterian. And that's where they started to think autistic conditions, not a disintegrative disorder. Then in September 16, 1996, the ethics approved applications made for research projects, but were never carried out. This was a project investigating as if a disintegrative disorder was the issue. Then in December 1996, the ethics approved approval for them to go ahead and do this research. But again, the doctors say it was never carried out. And then they had multiple approvals. Now, I asked Brian Deer in a one-hour debate 2 days ago whether or not he had this information. Indeed, he said he did. I said, was this information of approving testing on these children ever presented at court? He said, yes, it was. I wish to challenge Brian Deer. A careful examination of the records does not prove that this information indeed was there. In fact, when Brian Deer wrote his challenging article, and I have a copy of it in my hands, let me quote this. Quote, Lancet study children were all litigants, and seven admitted before ethical approval. Listen again, before ethical approval. Now, this page is research from an investigation by Brian Deer for the UK's Channel 4 television and the Sunday Times into a campaign linking the MMR children's vaccine with autism. And in this, it states the people's names of the company's vaccine and the date that they were admitted. What I have, and to my knowledge, I am the only journalist in the world to have the actual documents from outside of Brian Deer from the Royal Free Hospital. Again, I am the only journalist anywhere in the world outside of Brian Deer to have these. And I have them in my hand. For example, from the Royal Free Hospital, University Department of Pediatric Gastroenterology, the date, 27th of February, 1997, Miss Maureen Carroll, Secretary of the Ethics Practice Subcommittee, gives permission for the, quote, taking of extra mucosa biopsies for research purposes during the course of upper endoscopy in children. Now, I have multiple letters on multiple occasions granting permission for the type of in-depth clinical observation and analysis that was necessary to determine what's going on in these children. So on the one hand, very important for you to understand this, I cannot find any evidence that what I have in my hand that Brian Deer had was actually given to the court. And I believe had the court had this information in hand and had saw that every single one of the pieces of research they did on these children had been pre-approved in writing by the Royal Free Hospital, that the doctors being challenged, including Andrew Wakefield, would have had a completely different outcome. My question then is, why did Brian Deer not turn over all these documents that he had to the commission? And then the other question, which I'll be asking one of the leading barristers to the Supreme Court of England in all civil litigation, is this legal? Is it not legal? He will give us the answer. But just so this audience knows that we have information, we have prima facie evidence that all the doctors, including Wakefield, sought and received absolute, incontrovertible, complete approval to do the research on these children. You will see why that is important shortly, because that's part of the whole basis that these kids were experimented on. Now to a larger issue. That's why I say I'm going to weave several together here, and I'll continue with our timeline. So now, let us look at the larger issue. One is that we've been told that vaccines are safe and effective. At no time has any governmental agency in the United States or the United Kingdom said that they were going to create or disperse into the population, children or adults or senior citizens or pregnant women or those who are sick, any vaccine that was highly experimental, not proven safe or not proven effective. With every single vaccine, and no exception, they are always done. The only time there has been an exception was with all of the armed forces personnel going into the Gulf War, and they were given experimental vaccines of botulism and anthrax with squalene and other unapproved for that use by the FDA. They were given a waiver. Interesting, for 18 years, I have been the primary, if only, major journalist in the world trying to bring to the U.S. public's attention, to the VA, to the Defense Department, to the White House, to various administrations, major documentation showing that Gulf War syndrome was a real. We were told it was not. It was all in their minds. Then we were told it was post-traumatic stress disorder. There are now over 75,000 dead American soldiers who served in the Gulf Theater from the First and Second Gulf, and their deaths are attributable to Gulf War syndrome. Many of those people never served in combat. Many who suffer from Gulf War syndrome and severe neurological disorders, gastrointestinal disorders, immune dysfunction disorders, the only thing that they had that was common and unique to them was the experimental vaccines. They are still given those experimental vaccines, massive amounts. But when asked for their medical records of which vaccines they were given, what were in the vaccines, the Defense Department, the Veterans Administration, all have refused to acknowledge at any point that they had the right to this information, and therefore no soldier has been given all the information. To the contrary, in one case, over 70,000 of those documents mysteriously disappeared when we were exploring what was in the vaccines. So we do have precedent for experimental vaccines causing massive biological disorder in some of the healthiest, youngest people who could receive them, who had no other previous disorders until they received those vaccines. So now we have this situation that virtually every vaccine or combination of vaccines are approved, and yet we will develop an argument later in this program, in the second hour, that there is no research proving the safety and efficacy of any of these vaccines as individual or combinations over long periods of time in a placebo-controlled group, ever. Therefore, we have been misled. Now, why we have been misled and the consequences if we were able to determine that the MMR vaccine was dangerous, just set aside autism and look at all the other conditions that it may be contributing to, would mean that the British government would have been held legally responsible and therefore could have cost them over $1 trillion in damages. $1 trillion, virtually bankrupting the entire British government. Therefore, I am seeking a cause of motive of why would the British government, and by extension, the British Medical Journal and their British Medical Commission, go after these doctors? What would have been their motive? Well, that's a big motive. We will explore that. In the United States, let me give actual statistics. The following data is compiled by U.S. Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. The data is state collected and shows the total of U.S. young children ages 6 to 21 in full-time education with a formal diagnosis of the DSM-4 autism. The total is updated every year, and here's what it is. In 1994, there were 22,780 cases. In 2009, there are 335,199. By extension, by 2010, over 400,000. That is almost a 1,500% increase in that relatively short period of time. And that would mean that there is no other disease, not cancer, not arthritis, not obesity, no disease in the United States that has had a 1,500% increase. And yet I will show you later that it is not possible to be due to genetics. So that we must understand that the population in the United States is approximately 312 million, and in the United Kingdom it is 62 million, and therefore the population in the United Kingdom is approximately 20% of that of the United States, and the health regimes of the two countries are broadly similar, and so applying a 20% estimate to the U.S. autism figures for young people ages 6 to 21 in full-time education will give the U.K. estimate of about 87,000. Now, the cost of that, if it were shown that it were due to the vaccines, would just be astronomical. And therefore, one more reason for cover-up. That said, let me involve our panelists now, and I will be interspersing important information as we go. Dr. Henry Wakefield will be my first guest. My second guest will be Jim Moody. He is Dr. Wakefield, U.S. Attorney and current director of the Family Advocacy Organization in the National Autism Association and the research think tank Safe Minds. And he consults with the Petitioner Steering Committee on Autism Cases in the Vaccine Court. My second guest will be Clifford Miller. He is a major barrister, a solicitor of the Supreme Court of Civil Proceedings in Great Britain, and he specializes in matters involving vaccination science. Then Dr. Edward Yazbak. He is a board-certified pediatrician since 1963, a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics. He is a medical expert for the Social Security Administration Office of Disability Adjudication and Review, a former assistant clinical director of the Charles Chaplin Hospital, an associate member of the Institute of Health Science at Brown University, and director of pediatrics at the Woonsocket Hospital in Rhode Island. So for more than 35 years, he has been a practicing board-certified pediatrician, and also he is a research scientist on autoimmune regressive autism and vaccine injury. He's extensively written and published in peer-reviewed journals. More importantly to our discussion, Dr. Yazbak's grandson is autistic and was treated at the Royal Free Hospital by Dr. Wakefield and Walker Smith. And finally, Isabella Thomas, who has two autistic children who were part of the original 12 patients at the Royal Free Hospital study, and also a person who is speaking out on behalf of other parents. And I will also read a separate report from one of the additional parents who today gave me a special insight on her child's condition. Therein is our study. Let us begin. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Wakefield. Nice to have you with us. Dr. Wakefield,
thank you so much.
I will be at you. You were attacked on my program, and therefore I felt necessary to bring you on to have you address the issues that that Brian Deere had stated. You'll have an opportunity hearing his exact, in context, unedited statements, and then if you would give us your response and, wherever possible, documentation to support your response. All right?
Certainly, Gary. And may I just say congratulations on taking an in-depth look at this. It's so rare amongst journalists now that that actually takes place. So, well done.
Thank you. Let us begin. Let us hear first the first challenge by Brian Deere towards you. Let's get our audio going from my engineer, please. Okay, we're having a little computer difficulty. As soon as that's ready, I have the actual transcript, so I will read it. It's squarely an allegation against Wakefield. He did it. Now, the quote, this is Deere. Quote, the other authors didn't actually know which child was which. The other 12 authors really couldn't speak to the veracity of the data. He claims based on their medical records and the information that they provided to him, but in fact they didn't know. So that's involving his statement against you. Would you respond, please?
Certainly, Gary. Let me just put this in context so that people understand the nature of Brian Deere and where he's coming from. His first foray into investigation of autism, at least the first that I'm aware of, was gaining access to the home of a mother, one of the parents of the one of the Lancet 12 children, under a false name, and claiming that he was a health correspondent from the Sunday Times newspaper. Now, this is an extraordinary piece of journalism that he lied to a a distressed mother whose child was severely injured in order to deceive her, and has expressed on the internet that he is proud of having done so. And that really is someone that we need to look at very, very carefully when interpreting what he's saying. Now, in terms of his first allegation, it was Wakefield that did it. This seeks to isolate me from my co-authors. There were 13 authors on that paper. Between us, we published thousands of scientific and medical papers in highly reputable journals. It's extraordinary that these colleagues of mine would suddenly have an absence and forget to check the records of these children who they investigated clinically prior to publishing. In fact, what Mr. Deer has done is to conflate two time points. When we published the paper, all of my colleagues knew who these children were. Indeed, they'd investigated them. The findings were fascinating. They were very concerning to all of us. And when the paper was published in 1998, all of the authors had an opportunity to check the data to make sure that what was in the paper was truly representative of their clinical findings. Not my findings, but their clinical findings. However, when it came to 2004 and Brian Deer's allegations, there now has been 6 years of time elapsed. My colleagues needed to be reminded who the 12 children were in terms of their chronological order. That was what actually he was referring to when they said they didn't know who the children were. When the paper was published, they knew exactly who they were. 6 years later, they needed to be reminded. And that is an example of the way in which his misleading journalism has created this this perception of deceit.
All right, let's go to some specific clips and what he stated in an interview with me 2 days ago. If my engineer has been able to get the clips, we'll take them. Go, please.
He had no IRB approval to do this kind of research on young children.
Your response, please. Did you
have
approval?
As you have already pointed out, there was the research that was done that was published in The Lancet was research on biopsies. Specifically, it was an expert review, a blinded review. That is, the senior pathologist did not know the histories of the children or their diagnosis. He merely gave an interpretation of the disease findings in their intestine. And that research was covered by the ethical approval, or IRB approval, 16295, referring to the year 1995 that it was awarded, and it encompassed the work that was done. So yes, this work was covered by an appropriate ethical approval. That ethical approval was known to Mr. Deer and was in his possession, but for some reason he appears to have not disclosed it to the General Medical Council in evidence. And it was, in fact, adduced in evidence into the General Medical Council proceedings only by Professor Walker Smith and his team. Unfortunately, that was too late, and it did not have the impact that it should have had on the hearing's outcome.
I also understand that he did not give all of the documents of approval, only two. Let's go a little further with this. I have another clip. Please respond to it.
He fabricated the findings both by manipulating the admissions criteria for the study, where he was bringing in specific target children.
Respond, please.
I'm not quite sure what he means by that, but let me tell you what I think he means, and that is this issue of disintegrative disorder. Disintegrative disorder and autism are part of the autistic spectrum. Their presentation is virtually identical. They are indistinguishable. The difference between the two disorders is that in childhood autism, classical autism as described by Leo Kanner, the child was usually problematic from the very beginning. They had problems from their birth. They didn't want to be picked up or make eye contact or anything like that. Disintegrative disorder, on the other hand, requires a period of normal or near normal development by definition. And that is exactly what the children had who came to see us. Now, we knew nothing about this at the time, so we asked the child psychiatrist, Mark Barilovitz, to get involved because he was an expert in this field. And when he heard the histories of these children, he said, "This sounds to me much more like disintegrative disorder." And so the original protocol that was brought together to investigate these children, the one that was never used, in fact, 1972-96, described disintegrative disorder. As it went on, as the study went on, as more and more children came in, it became clear that this was a regressive pattern of autism. The rest is semantics. They had regressive autism that was indistinguishable from a disintegrative disorder. So there was no manipulation of the inclusion criteria. The children were seen for clinical reasons, first and foremost because they had intractable gastrointestinal symptoms from which they were suffering, which no other doctors appear to have taken seriously.
We'll continue on. Another challenge for you.
He also went through the results, manually altering test results and diagnoses and histories of the children, so as to create the appearance that there was a link between MMR and autism.
Okay, and this is the crucial point, and this is really where you have trapped Brian Deer in the big lie. Because this is an extremely important point, and I'm going to go through this so that your listeners understand in very simple, very clear terms what actually happened. Let's take, first of all, the clinical histories. Now, each child was referred to Professor John Walker Smith in the Department of Pediatric Gastroenterology at the Royal Free for their clinical symptoms. And Professor Walker Smith was sent a referral letter by the primary care physician. That was either a pediatrician or a general practitioner. So we had that evidence in the referral letter. The letter was based upon the medical records held for each child by their primary care physician. We did not have access to those records. Those are the records that Brian Deer has compared with the Royal Free records. Remember, we did not have access to those original primary care physician records. All we had was a referral letter. What we had in addition, which was very helpful, is a thing called the Red Book. Now, in the UK, every child has what is called the Red Book. And the Red Book records their immunizations and their health. The mother keeps the book, and a health visitor, a senior nurse, comes to the home on a regular basis for every child and does a formal developmental assessment, a prospective developmental assessment. And those records were used as a very good measure of the child's early development. Brian Deer did not, by his own admission, have those records. So how he can say that what was written in the Lancet paper differed from the childhood developmental records, I do not know, because he at no time was in possession of those records. So what we based our appraisal on and what was included accurately in the Lancet paper came from the GP's letter, it came from the Red Book, the prospective developmental records, and the fresh clinical history taken by Professor Walker Smith at the Royal Free. And that was faithfully and accurately transcribed into the paper itself. Brian Deer, on the other hand, provided a comparison in the British Medical Journal between the GP's primary records and what was published in the paper. We did not have access to the GP's primary records. Brian Deer knew that. And so what Brian Deer has fabricated is an inappropriate comparison. Now, let me just give your listeners an example of this and why it's so important. Take child one. We said in the paper that the child's first behavioral problems started a week after his MMR vaccine. The mother described him as having been delirious. In the general practitioner records, Brian Deer noted that there was an entry sometime before the MMR saying mother concerned about hearing. We did not have access to that record, and the mother did not report this to us. Brian Deer claims that hearing problems are usually a prodromal symptom of incipient autism. However, and so in comparing the GP records with what was written in the Lancet, he has alleged that we committed fraud. When we got access to those general practitioner records during the General Medical Council hearing, then a simple perusal of that entry in the GP record showed that it said, mother concerned about hearing, discharge from left ear. In other words, the child had an ear infection, an otitis, with potentially a perforated eardrum. That is more than enough reason for the mother to be concerned about his hearing. But Brian Deere selectively omitted the reference to the discharge from the ear. That is fraud.
There is one other piece of this puzzle that I have examined. I have in my possession an email from inside the Rural Free Hospital dated the 24th of February 2004 at 1401. It is from one of the major staff, and it says, quote, interesting. Some of these letters I have not seen and were definitely not amongst those that were released to Deere. So what the charade about getting hold of the papers from us is not clear. Then below that, in a response at 1331, is Brian Deere has put this back up on his website. Now, from my understanding of this, that means that that this shows the Royal Free Hospital, where you were doing your work, possibly had someone who was feeding Brian Deere information. And if that is the case, that is illegal. If Brian Deere accepted information that was being fed to him, we will ask whether or not that was illegal. And therefore, it is clear that if Brian Deere had knowledge that you all didn't have, and that no one could have had, then how did he receive that information? Your thoughts, please.
Well, this is synonymous with the extraordinary lengths that people will go to bring about the discrediting of this work. The violation of patient privacy, the disclosure of records to a journalist, the release of documents which are sub judice in the measles, mumps, rubella litigation, the pressure from the British government directly upon the dean of my medical school to stop the work because they, the government, had underwritten the pharmaceutical industry's liability for a knowingly dangerous, a knowingly problematic MMR vaccine when it was first introduced. Gary, it goes on and on. It is extraordinary. And when I talk to journalists about this in the mainstream who have largely made up their minds already, they put it down to conspiracy, as if to dismiss what is going on. Well, I'm afraid, whatever you might want to call it, conspiracy or ruthless, pragmatic crushing of dissent, it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant. These are the facts. This is what happened. And the abuse of parents, the way in which they have been disgracefully used and their children's records placed upon websites is appalling. And clearly, Mr. Deere's motive is not one of compassion. Not one of compassion at all. So will we ever discover the truth about where the funding for this exercise has come from? Who is dangling this puppet? I don't know. What I do know is that the truth about what actually happened at the Royal Free will come out. Parents already distrust vaccine regulators. Parents are not anti-vaccine. Parents are anti-vaccine regulator, in effect, because they believe they've been lied to. And that is not going to get any better until there is some transparency and honesty in this whole affair.
Okay, let's go to a few other of the comments. Our next comment from Brian Deere.
He was phoning the individual family doctors, and he was phoning individual patients to get specific target patients into the hospital. And having got them into the hospital, they then sought referral letters, and the referral letters were very often set out quite clearly, in some cases, that children had shown developmental problems before they were vaccinated. In other cases, the letters and other materials that were gathered together and the histories taken at the hospital itself show that other children had their developmental problems many months after vaccination and not within 14 days, as Wakefield claimed.
Your response.
Hi, Gary. Do you want to answer that?
Yes.
Right. The admission process for these children is not in any way as Mr. Deer describes. Let me just give you a rundown of this. What happened was, starting with Rosemary Keswick on the 17th of May 1995, long before I'd ever heard of litigation in respect of MMR, indeed the first time that I'd heard about autism since being at medical school, I said, I don't know how to help you. We don't have a pediatric gastroenterology unit here at the Royal Free yet. One is coming here, Professor Walker-Smith, but I do know someone who can help you, and that is Professor Walker-Smith. And her concern at that stage was that her child was having intractable diarrhea, abdominal pain, bloating, distension, failure to thrive. He clearly needed help, but his problems had been dismissed because he was autistic, and therefore his various gastrointestinal issues were to be expected. And so I said, you will need a referral letter from your general practitioner to Professor Walker-Smith. That is a standard practice in the National Health Service. And so that's what she did. And Professor Walker-Smith saw her with her son and then followed her up at the Royal Free, where he was scoped and his bowel disease was confirmed. She alerted me to the fact that there were many children in the same position and many mothers who wanted help for their children. And so a steady stream of calls came to me. I said to each and every one of those parents, you will need a referral to Professor Walker-Smith. But if you would like me to talk to your doctor and give them a generic background to what we are thinking, what we think may be the link between the bowel disease and the brain in children, what may be the problem underlying this issue, then I would be very happy to do so in a collegial manner, speaking to a colleague about what we think is going on. It was not my place to make a decision about whether the child should or should not be referred to Professor Walker-Smith, nor was it my place to decide whether the children should be admitted for investigation or not. It was a simple, straightforward exercise that was not in any way involved with litigation, but was designed to get these children the care that they needed. It has been misconstrued deliberately to make it into some kind of secret, malevolent act to experiment on these children. That has no bearing on the truth whatsoever.
Take another question, comment from Brian Deer, please.
Dr. Wakefield went on Fox News just a couple of days ago and said the U.S. vaccine court had accepted that MMR caused autism.
There are at least three cases that I can cite now where the MMR vaccine or vaccines in combination with MMR have resulted in a child's autism and have resulted in an award being made by that child. Bailey Banks is one, a child who suffered acute disseminated encephalomyelitis after the MMR and developed a pervasive developmental disorder on the autistic spectrum. The other is Misty Hyatt from Pensacola in Florida, who was awarded $5 million for autism following the MMR vaccine. And, of course, you know very well about Hannah Poling, who received 9 vaccines on the same day, including her MMR, and became autistic. Whether or not the courts, in nuancing the words, have accepted that autism, Poole syndrome autism, can be caused by these vaccines is neither here nor there. The American public are not deceived by the notion that the vaccine led to her autism, but we don't accept that it caused it. This, I'm afraid, is a disgraceful misuse of the English language, and parents are not misled by that. And that is why the mistrust of the regulators and those who are responsible for caring for these children after the damage has occurred are rapidly losing their faith in the system, because they know that they are being lied to.
All right, we'll take another one.
He'd been paid by a firm of lawyers to create this evidence. He was being paid a very substantial sum of money, something like $750,000 US dollars, to produce this information.
Right. When, in 1996, I agreed to take part in litigation as a medical expert. Many doctors take part as medical experts in litigation, either on the side of, for example, the manufacturer, the vaccine manufacturer, or on behalf of the claimants, in this case, the children. So there was nothing unusual about that. I most certainly was not paid by lawyers to manufacture this evidence. That is ridiculous. First of all, I did not manufacture the evidence. The evidence is based upon the clinical observations and test findings by experts in their fields, including Professor Walker Smith and his team. They were not my findings. The children were investigated for their clinical concerns, and at the time that they were referred to the Royal Free, not one child was involved in litigation. Not one. In other words, they were referred to the Royal Free for investigation and treatment of their clinical problems. It had nothing to do with litigation at all. And this is part of Brian Deer's fanciful construct, is that this was all intended to discredit the MMR and to bring down the MMR vaccine. And it was a conspiracy by me and by a lawyer. That is not true, and it's quite clear that from the fact that Rosemary Keswick contacted me at least 6 months before I'd ever heard of the MMR litigation, that it could not have been true. I was paid as an expert over the 9 years that I worked on the MMR litigation. I made a decision some years back, which I explained to my colleagues in great detail, that I felt these children should have access to the process of justice, not that to prove that the MMR vaccine caused their autism, but to do the appropriate science in order to establish that. And my group were provided with a grant, had nothing to do with the Lancet paper whatsoever. Not one single cent of that grant was spent on the Lancet paper, and indeed it was not even available to be spent, that research grant, until after the Lancet paper had been submitted for publication, so it could have had nothing to do with it. And that grant was to look for evidence of measles virus in the diseased intestine of these children, and that work continued for several years. The grant went to the Royal Free Hospital. It did not go to me, but I was paid independently to write a report on this work over the 9 years. The proceedings, the proceeds from that work were substantially less than Brian Deer quotes, and in fact they were all donated by me to an initiative to build a new centre at the Royal Free for the investigation and care of patients with inflammatory bowel disease. So did I profit out of it? No. Did I lose my career? Did I lose my medical license? Did I lose my job? Did I lose my country? Yes. Would I do it again? I would like to think so, because these children are worth it.
Dr. Wakefield, you've had an opportunity to respond to most of the challenges of Brian Deer against you. I would like for you to hold on, because I have one question, and if you could give me a short answer, please. Is it your belief, I know that you're pro-vaccine, in fact, all the people in this are pro-vaccine, but is it your belief that vaccines historically have been proven safe or effective or both? Yes or no?
No.
Okay. We're going to play in a moment an extended clip, which is crucial to this entire discussion that the American public and this audience have never heard before. But before we go there, let me just read to this audience a letter that I sent to the British Medical Journal on this issue. I sent it to Dr. Fiona Godley, Dr. Tricia Groves, deputy editor, as well as the editor of the British Medical Journal, and it says the following. Dear Drs. Godley and Groves, I've hosted extensive coverage about the General Medical Council's decisions in the recent British Medical Journal articles concerning Dr. Andrew Wakefield on our public landline radio stations and the Progressive Radio Network, reaching a large international audience. We have extensively interviewed some of the parents of the Lancet study, lawyers and science journalists, and Dr. Wakefield himself regarding the matter. Yesterday, Brian Deer appeared for a full-hour broadcast on our afternoon program in Washington, D.C. During the course of our independent investigations, we have collected a series of questions that we believe it is incumbent upon the editors of the British Medical Journal to address. We have just confirmed that we will be broadcasting a special program focusing in greater detail about the Wakefield allegations tomorrow at noon over the public radio stations New York City and the tri-state area. Therefore, we encourage you to provide us with responses before our going on the air, as we will be hosting more extensive coverage in this matter in the very near future. We would appreciate your reviewing the questions outlined below and providing us with your responses. Any comments you provide will be important for the public record. We look forward to receiving your honest responses to this issue raised below. Sincerely, Gary Knoll, Ph.D., National Radio Talk Show host, Richard Gale, executive producer, Progressive Radio Network. Questions for the British Medical Journal. 1. Do the British Medical Journal editors stand by their January 6, 2011 editorial Wakefield article linking MMR vaccine and autism was fraudulent, alleging Andrew Wakefield alone and unassisted committed research fraud? This relates to the 1998 Lancet Medical Journal early report calling for more research into a finding of a new bowel syndrome in children exhibiting autistic symptoms. 2. The editors of the British Medical Journal claim, quote, Wakefield altered numerous facts about the patient's medical histories in order to support his claim to have identified a new syndrome, unquote, and based this substantially on a comparison between early general family doctor records and what was reported in the Lancet early report. Do the British Medical Journals dispute that, 1, it was impossible for that to be done by anyone, as they have alleged, 2, it could not have been done by Andrew Wakefield, 3, none of the other 12 expert specialist medical professionals at the Royal Free Hospital worked from or even saw these patient medical histories. Those experts carried out their own investigations afresh, and Dr. Wakefield faithfully reported the data and results provided by his other 12 expert professional colleagues. 3. If these matters are disputed, can the British Medical Journal produce the data and results provided to Dr. Wakefield by his 12 colleagues and demonstrate where exactly the Lancet early report diverges? 4. If the editors cannot produce evidence, do they now retract their editorial and the paper by Mr. Brian Deere upon which it is based and which they also published? 5. Can the editors confirm that neither they nor Mr. Deere had sight of or access to the, quote, prospective developmental records, unquote, of the 12 Lancet children, meaning the red books? These were used as part of the basis for detailed clinical histories investigating afresh early signs of disintegrative disorder. 6. Do the editors agree that the family doctors would not have considered, quote, disintegrative disorder, nor looked for early signs? 7. If the editors still stand by their story, how do they account for the fact that those 12 specialists at medical expert professionals read and reviewed the Lancet paper before submission for publication, approved Wakefield's report of their work, and put all of their names in the paper? 8. Do the editors accept that by accusing Dr. Wakefield of fraud, they are also accusing all the other 12 experts? 9. Do the editors also accuse the authors of the following papers of fraud for claiming to have found the same or a closely similar condition in autistic patients? And then I go through here different peer-reviewed journals, the American Journal of Gastroenterology, and the volume, and the names of the authors, and the title of the article. For example, IBD-like disease in a patient with regressive autism is shown for the first time by the wireless capsule enteroscopy, another piece of the jigsaw of the gut-brain syndrome. Or in another journal, Gastroenterology, Volume 128, Supplemental 2, and this is autistic enterocolitis, confirmation of a new inflammatory bowel disease in an Italian cohort of patients. Or a third, in the Gastroenterology, 2006 supplemental report, beneficial behavioral effects of irritable bowel disorder therapy and gluten casein free diet in an Italian cohort of patients with autistic enterocolitis followed over 1 year, and I go on to list others, all of which show very similar work as that of the original work done by Dr. Deere and colleagues. That was the letter that we sent to the British Medical Journal. We have not heard back from them, but I'm hopeful we will, so that we can see their perspective. Any final comment from you, Dr. Wakefield?
No, Gary, I'm just very grateful that you've taken the trouble to do this in-depth research. It's long overdue, and I think this is the turning point in all of this, this very, very sorry episode. What's been forgotten in all of this, tragically, is the children who are suffering, and one of the fallouts from this fraud that's been perpetrated by Mr. Deere and the British Medical Journal in their failure to do due diligence is the fact that the children will not get appropriate investigation for the gastrointestinal problems, because people will be able to say, oh, well, it was all a scam, it was all a hoax, and therefore we don't need to take their gastrointestinal problems seriously, and that is a tragedy.
I have one final quick answer from you, if you would, please. Anytime any physician or research study is occurring and you are having the parent, especially of children, have a book that they're using, in this case the Red Book, and it is in that Red Book that they're determining the success or failure of any therapeutic model, the degree to which the child is responding, and the events that a child is going through and the markers they are reaching or not reaching that normally would be expected in that developmental period, is that not crucial to the entire argument that they had a special form of gastrointestinal disturbance with or without autistic symptoms? And isn't that crucial to the entire basis that what all 12 of you were doing and exploring was indeed legitimate, since you had finally found this connection? And without those parents' records, and without the court having those records, and Brian Deere never having read those records, and the American media and the European press and the British Medical Journal never seeing those records, how in the world, under any reasonable concept, could anyone make a decision that would be considered absolute and irrevocable that you had committing, or anyone else had committed any fraud?
You're absolutely right, Gary. It is reckless. In the absence of the appropriate evidence, it is reckless to make that kind of allegation. It shows, it reflects upon the diligence that we applied to the investigation of these children at the Royal Free, and the cavalier attitude of those who are seeking, desperately seeking, to prove that what we said was wrong.
Well, that is where we're going in the next part of our investigation. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you very much, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, for sharing your points of view. You were slandered on this show. You were attacked personally by Brian Deere. I gave you an opportunity to respond exactly to his verbatim in-context statements. Let us now go over to my next panelist, Clifford Miller. This, by the way, is an extended version of our normal one-hour program. We will go 2 hours and possibly three. I will not get off the air today till this incomplete statement story is unveiled. And before we go to my guest, Clifford Miller, who is a solicitor, which is a lawyer practicing before the Supreme Court in England in civil proceedings and a specialist in vaccine, I think that it's important that we all hear the following. And why should we hear this? And why is this important? Because the most important aspect of any vaccine is that it is safe and effective. So if you start off dismissing all that has been done by the 12 independent investigators, all with impeccable backgrounds and credentials, never once having a problem in their entire careers, all at the top of the field in the world, board certified, published authors, and suddenly we are to believe that they're all guilty of fraud, that they somehow decided to make things up and alter patients, for what possible reason? Then I have to ask, well, what could be the motive on the other side? What if it were shown that vaccines were not safe, that we were not starting with a pure medium, an uncontaminated medium, one that was free of any altered DNA or foreign DNA? Then that would raise questions, serious questions. You mean you're starting with something that is contaminated? Well, then what proof do you have, what studies have you done, that any of these particular contaminants could not in any long or short-term measure in compromised immune systems or healthy individuals cause some form of biological disruption? No such studies have been done, because we have all, everywhere, the U.S. Public Health Service, the FDA, the CDC, the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, and all of the same corresponding medical organizations in Germany and France and Italy and the United Kingdom start off with the exception expectation that all vaccines are safe and effective. Before we go to our guest, I believe it's important that we hear from the man who is considered the single most important discoverer of vaccines in the world. His name is Dr. Maurice Hilleman. Dr. Hilleman discovered more vaccines than anyone else, including the pertussis vaccine and the hepatitis vaccines and many of the individual vaccines that are given. So there is no one who is considered more significant than Dr. Marie Sullivan. By the way, some of the land-based stations will be going off this program in 60 seconds. You can continue listening over the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. If you forget Progressive Radio Network, go to GaryNoll.com. So now, here we have Dr. Maurice Hillman, and he is at the end of his life. He was considered the godfather of all vaccines. No human being in Europe and the United States has ever been given the attention, respect, focus of Dr. Hillman. He oversaw all the major vaccines. It was under his purview that even the live virus Sabin vaccine was being produced. And here's something he said at the end of his life, his mea culpa, and this, ladies and gentlemen, you have not heard.
And I think that vaccines have to be considered the bargain basement technology for the 20th century.
50 years ago, when Maurice Hillman was a high school student in Miles City, Montana, he hoped he might qualify as a management trainee for the local JCPenney store. Instead, he went on to pioneer more breakthroughs in vaccine research and development than anyone in the history of American medicine. Among the discoveries he made at Merck are vaccines for mumps, rubella, and measles.
Tell me how you found SV40 in the polio vaccine.
Well, that was a Merck thing. Yeah, I came to Merck, and I was going to develop vaccines. And we had wild viruses in those days. You remember the wild monkey kidney viruses and so forth. And I finally, after 6 months, gave up. I said that you cannot develop vaccines with these damn monkeys. We're finished. And if I can't do something, I'm going to quit. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try it. Mm-hmm. So I went down to see Bill Mann at the zoo in Washington, D.C. And I told Bill Mann, I said, look, I got a problem. I don't know what the hell to do. Bill Mann is a real bright guy. I said, these lousy monkeys are picking it up while being stored in the airports in transit at these loading, offloading. Mm-hmm. He said, it's very simple. He said, you go ahead, get your monkeys out of West Africa, and get the African green, bring them into Madrid, unload them there. There are no other traffic through there for animals. Fly them into Philadelphia, pick them up. Or fly them into New York and pick them up. Right off the airplane. So I brought African greens, and I didn't know we were importing AIDS virus at the time.
So what he did, he brought in those monkeys.
Now we had those. And this was the solution. Because those monkeys didn't have the wild viruses. But we had all
these... Why didn't the greens have the wild viruses since they came from
Africa?
Because
they weren't... They weren't being infected in these group-holding things with all the other 40 different viruses.
But they had the ones they brought from the jungle, though.
Yeah, they had those, but there were relatively few. What you do is you have a gang housing, you're going to have an epidemic transmission of infection in a confined space.
Oh, is that the problem?
So, anyway, the greens came in. Now we had these, and then we're taking our seed stocks to clean them up, and God, now I'm discovering new viruses. So I said, shoot, this priest. Well, I got an invitation from the Sister Kenny Foundation, which was the opposing foundation, and that was the live virus.
Oh, right.
Yeah, they had jumped on Sabin's bandwagon. Mm-hmm. They had asked me to come down and give a talk at the Sister Kenny Foundation meeting. And I said, it was an international meeting. I said, God, what am I going to talk about? I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk about the detection of non-detectable viruses as a topic.
There were those who didn't want a live virus vaccine. They concentrated. The National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis concentrated all its efforts on getting more and more people to use the killed virus vaccine. While they were supporting me, for research on the live virus vaccine.
So now I got to have something, you know, that's going to attract attention. So I thought, gee, that damn SB40. I mean, that damn vacuolating agent that we have. I'm going to just pick that particular one. Mm-hmm. That virus has got to be in vaccines. And it's got to be in Sabin's vaccine, so I quickly tested it. Sure enough, it was in there.
And I'll be down.
So now, so I go ahead and...
So you just took stocks of Sabin's vaccine off the shelf here at Merck?
Yeah, well, it had not been made at Merck. It was made at Merck.
You were making it for Sabin at this point?
Yeah, it was made before I came.
Yeah, but at this point, Sabin is still just doing these massive field trials.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
In Russia and so forth. So I go down, I talked about the detection of non-detected virus. I told Albert...
But at this point, Sabin is still just doing these massive field trials.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
In Russia and so forth. So I go down, I talked about the detection of non-detected virus. I told Albert, I said, listen, Albert, I said, you know, you and I are good friends. But I said, I'm going to go down there. You're going to get upset. But I'm going to talk about a virus that's in your vaccine now. You're going to get rid of the virus. Don't worry about it. You're going to get rid of it. But, so, of course, Albert was very upset with me.
And what did he say?
Well, he said basically that this is just another obfuscation that is going to upset vaccines. And I said, well, you know, you're absolutely right. And I said, we have a new era here. We have a new era of a detection. And the important thing is to get rid of these viruses.
Why would he call it an obfuscation if it was a virus that was contaminating
vaccines? Well, because there are 40 different viruses in these vaccines anyway that we were inactivating. But
you weren't inactivating his, though.
That's correct. No, that's right. But yellow fever vaccine had leukemia virus in it. And, this is in the days of very crude science. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I went down and talked to him. And I would say, well, why are you concerned about it? I said, well, I'll tell you what. I said, I have a feeling in my bones that this virus is different. I don't know why to tell you this, but I've been around biology a long time. I just think this virus may have some long-term effects.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, what? I said, oh, cancer.
I love it. Go ahead.
No. I said, Albert, I said, you probably think I'm nuts, but I just have that feeling. Well, in the meantime, we had taken this virus and put it into monkeys and into hamsters.
Uh-huh.
So we had this meeting, and that was sort of the topic of the day, and the jokes that were going around was, gee, we would win the Olympics because the Russians would all be loaded down with tumors. This is where the vaccine was being tested. This was interesting.
Right.
So, and it really destroyed the meeting. You know, it was a big image.
Yeah, right.
So it was sort of a topic. You know. Anyway.
Was this the Cancer Society meeting in New York?
Sister Kenny.
Oh, it was Sister Kenny. Right.
And Del Becco got up and said that he foresaw problems with these kinds of agents.
Why didn't this get out in the press?
Well, I guess it did. I don't remember. We had no press release, and obviously you don't go out. This is a scientific affair within the scientific community. This is a scientific affair within the scientific community.
Hey, everyone. What I want you to do is appreciate what you just heard. You just heard the most famous and important vaccine developer in world history acknowledge that they were using in massive amounts vaccines, including the polio vaccine, that was contaminated with the SV40 virus, simian virus 40, which would later end up causing unusual cancers and immune defects. They knew at the time that they had a problem they decided to cover up. They figured it'll take a long time before any of this manifests, and indeed it did. And finally, the United States government had to acknowledge, yes, they did continue to give contaminated vaccines. And why did they continue? Because they didn't, quote, want to create a panic in the public. So, in other words, if you expose someone to something that can cause a serious adverse health reaction, you don't want them to get upset. Well, how are they supposed to feel when they do get that disease and they don't know its origins and possibly don't know how to treat it? So this shows that there is no such thing as a completely clean virus. And if you saw how they made the polio virus, you would never have it. So I'm suggesting that before we jump ahead of, does autism relate in any way to the MMR vaccine or other conditions, let us be very clear. No one with any scientific certainty can claim that all vaccines are safe. They are not. And we have tons of documentation to support that. Or that they're even effective. But yet we refuse to acknowledge that they are not safe and they're not effective. And therefore we carry on with these campaigns. The motives, the pharmaceutical industry, it's an enormous profit stream for them. The government, because the government more often than not selects scientists on its special advisory panels on scheduling of vaccines who are directly linked with the pharmaceutical company and receive money, stipends, royalties, patent fees for promoting their vaccines. And more than 50%, enough to make a crucial decision that a particular vaccine or combination of vaccines will be given in a schedule, continue to have virtually unimpeded access to public policy. So if it can be shown that vaccines were neither safe nor effective, if it can be shown that the U.S. Public Health Service, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, the CDC, allowed knowingly individuals to sit on their panels to recommend these vaccines where there was a conflict of interest, and that these vaccines then ended up causing problems, then the United States government would be held accountable and virtually would bankrupt it. You're talking about what would clearly be in excess of $1 trillion in the United States and in Great Britain alone. So there's a great deal of effort and motive not to allow any information to come out that would in any way imperil the free flow of information. We do not have an open society and freedom of choice of dialoguing on the subject of vaccines or on AIDS or many other conditions. In fact, one of the things Brian Deere also said was that once you're guilty, you're guilty. That's it. You know, he's been found guilty and it's over. Let's go on. Well, if that were only the case. In fact, in this specific instance, I received a little handwritten note from a man named Alan Yurko who was serving life in prison without being able to have parole. He was not only serving life in prison for shaking his baby to death, but he also was looked upon by the other prisoners as a despicable person. He was beaten up on all the time, had to be kept in solitary confinement. So when we finally, 2 years after that, got down to looking, I looked at all the evidence and something just didn't ring right. And yet he had been through the whole legal process, and he was now finished. So I began to investigate. And after several years, almost 7 years of investigation, finally, enough evidence was able to be brought together that showed that the information that was shown in his first trial was wrong. Information had been suppressed. Wrong information had been given. And we managed to get him a new trial. And I will never forget being in the courtroom, and we were the only ones in the courtroom down in Orlando, that no one else was in the courtroom, no other journalist or media, but we were there with our camera. Here is just a snippet of that in order to challenge Brian Deere that once you're found guilty, that's it. The case is over. Oh, no, Brian, it isn't.
Make sure what I was doing and the decisions I made for my child were safe. They failed. They're asleep at the switch.
The Honorable Seattle Lawson, Secretary of State.
Please be seated.
August 2004, after being in prison for 6 years, Alan Yurko is granted a retrial. On August 27th, the charges of shaken baby syndrome were dropped, and Alan Yurko was released from the Century Correctional Facility.
I can't explain how I felt walking out of the county jail. Even the prisoners that were, as I was walking out and walking by all the, you know, it's almost like a perp walk. I had to walk by hundreds of them. They were standing up and cheering, giving me thumbs up. That was... You know, I started thinking like Shawshank Redemption or something. It's just unreal. It's really unreal. Yes, they got in some good licks, but I think we won in that event in technical knockouts. We did great impeachment of their witnesses. They broke down. Their witnesses actually, at trial, never, ever conceded to any differential diagnosis. But here, once they saw that we had done our homework, they had to stick to the script. They had to say what was right. Yes, there were differential diagnoses for this. So I'm here, I'm free, I'm okay. I am really okay with how it turned out. We're opening some eyes, and that's a really good feeling. It's a really good feeling.
So the issue is this. We were able to get one man who was in prison for life out, show that he was innocent, and show that it was the vaccine that killed his baby. How many other thousands of children have died because of shaken baby syndrome, and it was not the parents? How many more parents are in prison for life, as was this one man who should not be there? And just another thing for Brian. Brian, I hope that you take the time to read the actual scientific literature on wrongful convictions. According to the latest research, up to 10% of the U.S. prison population are factually innocent of the crimes they were convicted of. What this means is that almost 200,000 convicts are innocent. Now, we have 81% of the time it's mistaken identification by witness. 51% of the time serology errors, meaning protein blood type, police misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct, forensic hair comparison errors, junk or sloppy science admitted to trial, bad lawyering, false confessions, deliberately false witness testimony, deliberately false snitching by informants, and DNA testing errors. So we have the actual statistics. So before we can state that everyone who's been convicted, found guilty, had their license revoked, is guilty and that's the end of it, no, it is not. Not by a long shot. That is just one example. And finally, before we go to our next guest, standing by, concerning the MMR vaccine, even if we did not associate it at all with autism, but just took a look at it from peer-reviewed literature, and I have peer-reviewed literature in my hands, for example, quote, live attenuated measles and mumps viral strain containing vaccines and hearing loss. This is from the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, and this is the United States. This is what has been accepted. Quote, hearing loss is a known complication of wild measles, mumps, viral infections. As vaccines against measles, mumps contain live attenuated viral strains, it is biologically plausible that in some individuals they could develop as a complication of vaccines against measles and mumps. That was one. Another, adverse events associated with MMR vaccines in Japan. And this was a large nationwide surveillance of four measles, mumps, rubella vaccines conducted in Japan. Over 1,255 pediatricians actively participated in the study, and they found that there were severe, serious adverse events after the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine during a 14-year prospective follow-up. And then there was a comparative evaluation of the effects of the MMR immunization and mercury doses from thimerosal-containing childhood vaccines on the population's prevalence of autism. The results of this study agree with a number of previously published studies. These studies have shown that there is a biologically plausibility and epidemiological evidence showing a direct relationship between increasing doses of mercury from thimerosal-containing vaccines, neurodevelopmental disorders, and measles-containing vaccines and serious neurological disorders. Then there's the antibodies, the measles, mumps, rubella in the UK, in children 4 years after vaccine with different MMR vaccines, and the persistence of antibodies at vaccines with these from the different manufacturers, and what the consequences were. Also, infection with human B lymphocytes with MMR vaccines induced IgE class switching. Another peer-reviewed journal, the incidence of rubella virus infections in Switzerland after the introduction of the MMR vaccination program. Another one, MMR vaccines, 800% autism risk. quote, a rerun of the 2002 Danish MMR vaccination autism study, but this time also included children ages 5 and over rather than cutting off at age 4, found the Danish autism rate had in fact risen 800% over the period since the introduction of the MMR vaccine. The children ages 5 and over were added in because in Denmark, a diagnosis of autism is never made until the age of 5. So you would not expect to find any diagnosis of autism in the 4 and unders, even were greater awareness and better diagnosis of autism judged to account for half of these cases. And that would still leave an extremely significant 400% increase, unquote. And then the sick monkeys, research links vaccines load and autism sign. Quote, the first research project to examine effects of the total vaccine load received by children in the 1990s has found autism-like signs and symptoms in infant monkeys vaccinated the same way. The study's principal investigator, Laura Hewitson from the University of Pittsburgh, reports developmental delays, behavioral problems, and brain changes in macaque monkeys that mimic, quote, certain neurological abnormalities of autism, unquote. Then another peer-reviewed journal, multiple deaths linked to childhood vaccines, and then another MMR vaccine, thimerosal and late-onset autism, autistic enterocolitis, and then another autism explosion, the vaccine connection. And so these are just a handful showing that with or without autism, there are many different biological consequences just to the MMR vaccine alone. And finally, from Professor of Pharmacology, Richard Death from Northeastern University, quote, the British Medical Journal has published a report by an investigative journalist on the first study to link a childhood vaccine to autism and inflammatory bowel disease. The article in the British Medical Journal called the study, quote, an elaborate fraud and claimed that the, quote, appearance of a link with autism was manufactured at London Medical School, unquote. Dr. Andrew Wakefield linked the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine to autism in a study published in the medical journal Lancet more than 10 years ago. Lancet retracted the study last year after the British General Medical Council found that Wakefield had acted, quote, dishonestly and irresponsibly in his research. Now, Richard Death is a professor of pharmacology at the Beauvais College of Health Sciences, the School of Pharmacy at Northeastern University. Now, his research suggests that vaccines containing aluminum and or the mercury-based preservative thimerosal could contribute to the development of autism in children who lack the genetic capability to excrete neurotoxic metals. The MMR vaccine does not contain aluminum or thimerosal. And Death, who is currently attending a vaccine safety conference, had this to say, quote, what are your thoughts on the British Medical Journal report? Here's what he says, quote, I think it's very unusual, but at the same time revealing that the British Medical Journal chose to publish this story, investigative journalist Brian Deer has been on a mission to discredit Wakefield for years. His report is not a scientific article, but rather an opinion piece that doesn't focus on the scientific finding of whether or not an autistic children has inflammation in their gastrointestinal tract, which I believe is the crux of the original paper. That paper never set out to prove or an explicit link between autism and the MMR vaccine. Nobody studying 12 subjects could conceive of proving a link. Wakefield found that subjects had gastrointestinal inflammation, and at least some of the parents reported that they thought this occurred after their child received the MMR vaccine. Our recent research has identified an amino acid transporter that may be involved in the gastrointestinal inflammation and might also contribute to the neurological inflammation that others have found in the brains of autistic children. A connection between the gut and the brain in autism makes sense to me. Question, what is the link between vaccine and autism? Answer, quote, vaccines provoke an immune response in an antigen derived from a virus or bacteria. They can also contain agents called adjuvants, such as aluminum, which augment the antibody response and can provoke inflammation throughout the body, as well as preservatives, such as mercury, in the form of thimerosal. Aluminum and mercury can enter the brain and remain for years, where they provoke neuroinflammation. Inflammation during childhood can interfere in normal mechanisms by which gene expression is controlled, leading to neurodevelopmental disorders such as autism. When the MMR vaccine does not contain aluminum or mercury, simultaneous exposure to these three viruses induces inflammation, which contributes to the cumulative effect on vaccines on children. It's common for children to receive several vaccines in a single doctor's visit. As a result, they receive a tremendous dose of aluminum, well beyond limits set by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. This increases the chance of excessive inflammation and a metabolic condition known as oxidative stress, which can disrupt developmental and precipitate a regressive autism. Studies of autistic children show that they have inflammation and oxidative stress. Question, why haven't other studies shown a link between the MMR vaccine and autism? Answer, quote, most vaccine safety studies have been epidemiological in nature. They examine large population-based data sets rather than individual autistic subjects. The latter type of study has revealed the central role of oxidative stress and inflammation, which could not be identified in epidemiological studies. Epidemiological studies are intrinsically unable to uncover causal mechanisms, even if an association was found. In my view, the MMR vaccination is only a partial contributor, while other vaccines contribute to the total risk of autism. Vaccines are certainly not the only agents contributing to autism, but it's likely that the major cause is some kind of environmental exposure as opposed to a genetic abnormality. In light of this, should parents have their children vaccinated against MMR and other diseases? Answer, yes, I support vaccination and safer vaccines that don't contain mercury or aluminum. My next guest, standing by, Clifford Miller. Nice to have you with us today, Mr. Miller.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon, Gary. It's a pleasure to be on your show, and you just tell me where you want to go.
All right. Mr. Miller, for those of you who just tuned in, we have people all over the world tuning in, is a solicitor of the Supreme Court of England, civil proceedings, and he has spent a lot of time investigating vaccine issues in science. I'm going to go through five major questions for you. And if you could give us whatever documentation you have, and I want to redouble up on some of the issues involving Wakefield. First and foremost.
Well, can I just interrupt with one thing? The documents you have on the ethical approval, okay, those documents have never been in the General Medical Council proceedings. And a little bit earlier when you were talking with Dr. Wakefield, there was the impression that two of them may have been in, and it's significant. We need to come back to that. But you please carry on, Gary.
Okay. Let's go through the five major charges that are the basis of Brian Deere's personal investigation and the British Medical Journal accepting that and the British Medical Council using it. And the charges are that Wakefield solicited patients, that he had a financial motive, that he was going to create a rival vaccine to the MMR, that he changed the test results, and that it was all Wakefield who did this, and that he was paid by a firm of lawyers to create this evidence. Those are the primary charges against Wakefield. Now, you have investigated this in depth. Please share with us your answers.
Okay, well, I think if, Gary, you could take them questions one by one. I haven't written them down.
Let's start with that he selected the patients to come in here and cherry-pick the patients, and then so that this was not just a group of people coming to a center. These were his own hand-picked patients.
No, that's not possible. How's he going to go out into the entire United Kingdom and try and find these children and track them down and get them to the hospital? That's not true. My understanding is, and if Dr. Wakefield's still on, he can correct me, but my understanding is that one woman, one very determined, one very bright woman, very capable, high flyer, had a major position in marketing before the injury to her son, she was determined to find out what happened. And she tracked down Andrew Wakefield in 1995, and what people don't realize, of course, is that Andrew Wakefield was then a researcher. He wasn't a clinician going around treating patients. His role, my understanding is, to look into possibilities, come up with hypotheses, and then for treatment regimes, so that his colleagues, he was the thinker, if you want to put it in the simplest terms. The other guys are the expert doers, and he was the thinker. And he put his mind to this because no one had ever seen this before. What was coming through, nobody had seen it. So with Rosemary Keswick, she tracked him down. And other people got to hear about that. And they also were tracking down the Royal Free Hospital. And who wouldn't? If there is only one hospital in the entire world that is looking into these issues, people are going to find out, and they're going to send their kids there. It's really as simple as that. What are you going to do? Is it going to put up a big advertisement and then get people to put up a stand and say, please come to my hospital? No. People get to know by word of mouth and reputation what's going on, and they needed their kids seen. These were really sick kids. When you hear from Dr. Yazbek, you'll get a good idea of what was going on. So, does that help, Gary? Hello?
Yes. Thank you very much on that. Now, let's go forward. I'm very concerned about the idea that he was supposedly, out of 12 of the great scientists there, the only one who was responsible for tabulating everything, creating everything, and writing everything up.
Right. He did not generate the data and the results that he wrote up. His colleagues did. So, if you want to, first of there's two steps in this. If you want to allege a man has committed fraud, you don't go to see the Hollywood movie of the book, then read the book and decide the author is a fraud because there are too many words and the story is different. Okay? You don't do things that way around. So first of all, you need to compare what Andrew Wakefield used, the data and the results from the colleague from his colleagues, with what's in the Lancet paper. You don't go to the family doctor records, which they didn't use. So number one point here, it's absolutely impossible to level an allegation of fraud on the basis on which it's been done. And this is by editors of a world-leading medical journal. Now, I could say more on this, and if that's answered your question in part, shall I continue?
Yes.
Okay. So, have they got the data and results that Andrew Wakefield was given? And the answer is a big, big no. Brian Deer has confirmed he has never seen the developmental records, the red books. Have you had any answers from the British Medical Journal's editor today to your questions yesterday?
No, we have not.
Okay. Well, I can tell you this. Questions like that have been put to the British Medical Journal since they published on the 6th of January, and it has been a big, big silence. And if you want to post on there rapid response comments in relation to Mr. Deer's supposedly peer-reviewed article, and you put something on there remotely embarrassing, and they will not publish it, they have got complete radio silence. And we're talking about an organization that failed to carry out basic journalistic checks on what they were publishing. Absolutely fundamental checks. They clearly didn't check what Mr. Deer was writing for defamation against all of the Royal Free Hospital team players, all the members of that team, all the 13 of them. And they clearly didn't check it for contempt of court. It's a contempt of court to publish something that is a serious risk or substantial risk of prejudice to certain kinds of proceedings, and they include a pending appeal to the High Court from the General Medical Council. So this is under the Contempt of Court Act 1981, Sections 1, 2, and Paragraph 15, Schedule 1. Anyone can look them up on the web, and they will see it's a strict offense. Intent is irrelevant. Basic journalistic steps that trainee journalists learn at school,
So in other words, in lay language, if Brian Deer claimed, as he did on my program, that he had the documents that I also have, and if I'm understanding, I'm the only journalist outside of Brian Deane in the world who has these documents that prove that virtually all the research they did was granted and approved by the Royal Free Hospital, then to withhold those documents from the commission could put Brian Deane in serious jeopardy. Is that correct or incorrect?
In theory, if one withholds material evidence and one is acting on, one is under a duty to disclose it, that could constitute or give grounds for investigating an attempt to pervert the course of justice, which could possibly be a criminal matter. In practice, in the United Kingdom, over these issues, anything to do with the MMR vaccine or anything else like it, the entire establishment doesn't want to know. So if you're asking me, is anyone going to do anything if Brian Deer's done something very bad? I unfortunately regret to say I doubt it very, very much.
But do you feel that it's an ethical issue that if a journalist has information and he excludes the information that could exonerate someone or cast a different light on them and only includes the information that he has cherry-picked that can be shown, giving a different impression to those people, do you consider that an ethical breach?
It's more than an ethical breach. Brian Deer, when he wrote his first complaint to the General Medical Council to get them to investigate Andrew Wakefield, he wrote it on the 25th of February 2004, and one of the first things he said was that he was acting out of a public duty. Well, you don't act out of a public duty, give half the information over, and keep back all the stuff which could indicate that the defendants are innocent. And every single one of those documents, not one single document from the Royal Free Medical School referring to the ethical approval granted in 1995 was in the GMC proceedings, except for the fact that every single parent had signed an ethics consent form for the investigation of their children to be carried out under that ethical approval. So one, there isn't a single stick, stitch, or whatever you want to call it, of evidence that the 1995 approval was ever granted. There's not a document to be found. But Brian Deer had 7 or 8 items of correspondence and documents which clearly evidenced that from 1995 through to at least 2001, these doctors were carrying out colonoscopies and taking biopsy samples for research purposes under ethical approval.
Well, that's the entire case as far as fraud. So that means that if what I understand you're saying, Brian Deer intentionally withheld information that I have that would show that they did nothing wrong. They passed all the proper tests of doing it by the book. The parents were notified, and yet none of this ended up in their defense in hearings, and therefore the judges would have judged them differently.
The existence of this 1995 approval came in indirectly weeks into the hearing when Professor Walker Smith gave evidence, and there were just 2 documents, and they were not Royal Free Hospital documents. They were his letters that he wrote when he was at St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London, and he wrote seeking the transfer of his ethical. He had this ethical approval at St. Bartholomew's Hospital, or we call it Bart's over here. He had ethical approval at Bart's Hospital. He was going to move to the Royal Free, and it was his letters only that existed. That was the only evidence of the 1995 ethical approval. So Brian Deer had these specific series of correspondence spanning years, which showed very clearly that it was routine, there was ethical approval to routinely take extra biopsies for research purposes when carrying out colonoscopy. That's what they showed. And they showed numerous papers. I think one of them shows four research papers published by Professor Murch, who was in the GMC proceedings. So what that would have shown was that there was a clear pattern that these doctors were following. So if they had these documents, they would have been able to demonstrate that what we are saying is true. We never carried out any research under our proposal we put in 1996. These were the first kids that came along. We had our thinking caps on. We were treating them clinically. This is what they were saying. They were saying these children would have been treated anyway. Okay? We were giving them clinically necessary investigations because we had no one knew what was wrong with these kids, so we had to look at them carefully. And we took biopsies under our existing research ethics approval we got in 1995 when Walker Smith came to rule free.
I think we've covered that now. I have one final point. Our own internal investigation into the idea that, well, what was Wakefield's motive? Well, he was bringing out his own competitive single vaccine, the measles vaccines, to compete with the MMR vaccine, and it was a lot of money. He was going to make millions. Here is my investigation. I won't go into all of it because I don't want to compromise some of my sources. But this was not a vaccine to prevent the measles, mumps, or rubella. Rather, it was the only vaccine that would ever exist or has ever been done, though it was never tested. But he did apply for patent to research it, and it would have been years of research and testing and clinical studies before it would have been approved. But it would have been given only after a child had contracted the measles, to help the child's deal with that on an immune level. Now, right now, there is no treatment whatsoever that is effective once a child has measles, and therefore this would have been the first treatment once a child has measles, not to prevent it, but only once you have it. And therefore, when you consider how many children die in the world each year once they have measles, this quite simply could have been one of the most important medical discoveries in history, and Mr. Wakefield could have saved millions of lives, and that was what we have come up with. Instead, this has been portrayed that he was somehow trying to compete with the MMR vaccine, and I can find no evidence whatsoever to support he was trying to compete with it, and I can find no evidence that this was cast in the proper light. Your thoughts, please.
Well, you're absolutely correct. What I'd like to add to it and highlight, I don't do vaccine damage litigation. I'm a commercial lawyer and I'm a patent lawyer. Now, something I'd like to highlight here is that when Brian Deere writes his stories, how many times do you see him citing the opinion of an expert in a quote in his story as his standard journalism? Incredibly rarely or never. What you get from Brian Deere is Brian Deere quoting Brian Deere. And he's got no medical qualifications, no scientific qualifications whatsoever. It's not proper journalism. And this issue about this therapeutic treatment, I don't know whether vaccine is even the right term to use. What Andrew Wakefield was trying to do, he believed that these particular children had a persistent measles virus infection which they couldn't clear. So he was looking for something that would clear the measles virus infection from their bodies so that they could at least recover or wouldn't keep regressing. But the principle of this is potentially far-reaching, because in the third world, even the best estimates of claims of life-saving from vaccines are 25% of the children that would have died don't, so 75% still do. So if you've got an effective treatment for measles, and if you ask our British Department of Health, is there an effective treatment for measles? Their answer is no. So this would have been the first, assuming it worked, assuming it went through trials, and it was found, this would have been the number one first thing, and it could have been an incredible breakthrough in day-to-day healthcare and public health and in saving lives. Shadow of a doubt about it. And it could not supplant the existing vaccines. It could live side by side with them. If you wanted to go and vaccinate people in advance of them getting a disease, then fine, carry on with the existing ones. This one could only be used when there was infection, or in rare circumstances, you might possibly be able to use this like a week in advance or a couple of weeks in advance for heavily immunocompromised kids, so that if they're at risk, you can give this to them, and it may help protect them from a pending infection or exposure to infection slightly in advance. But there's nothing like giving someone a measles shot and expecting that for 15 years, you know, they're going to have no problem with the measles infection.
Well, we're going to deal with that in the next hour of our program when we meticulously go through the different people who have been fully vaccinated and then come down with an extremely challenging case of the very condition they were vaccinated for, and not in just a few cases. That is in our last hour. Clifford Miller, please keep on, because we're going on to other guests. You've given us a lot of good insight, and we appreciate it. Now my next guest is Jim Moody. Jim Moody is Dr. Wakefield's U.S. attorney and the current director of the family advocacy organization, the National Autism Association, and the research think tank Safe Minds. And he is here with us. He has degrees in artificial intelligence management from MIT and completed his law degree at Georgetown University. Nice to have you with us today, Jim.
Gary, hi, and thank you for doing this investigation. It's a real tribute to what indie media can do against mainstream media, which is so heavily funded by the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, completely funded. Just look at the commercials. One of the things that I always look for is motive. And here we just played an excerpt from Maurice Hilleman, the father of American vaccine, telling us, you know, about the SV40 virus. What was not in that was that there has never been anything to this day that can show a completely DNA-free vaccine. There are contaminants, adjuvants in every vaccine. But according to a memo written by to Dr. Gordon Douglas from Maurice Hilleman, and on this very subject, the topic was, quote, Vaccine Task Force Assignment, Thimerosal Methyl Preservative Problems Analysis Suggestions for Resolution. And then he goes into great depth in this particular memo about what's wrong with the vaccine that his own manufacturer, Merck, was making. And, of course, when you consider that here was a man trying to tell his own manufacturer, hey, we've got serious problems here, and they chose to do nothing about it. They chose to hide this information and later said, oh, it was in some box we didn't notice or didn't mark. Nonsense. So even the man who was the chief vaccine inventor said, well, you got, now this is aside from the viruses. This is aside from the leukemia-causing viruses. This was something else. This is the mercury. This is where it got really serious. They chose to ignore their own top man. So I just want people to know that every time we think that, oh, it's all, you know, safe and effective, you win with water, it isn't. So what I'd like for you to do is this, if you would please. I would like for you to go through what you consider the Achilles heel, the point that is irrefutable when it comes to the charges against Dr. Andrew Wakefield and his colleagues, and how, if this were really in a court where you could, where you had proper legal procedures and you could have witnesses and cross-examination and everything, what you feel would have been the outcome, and where you feel that the British Medical Council was imbalanced, and also how in the world could the British Medical Council come up with the findings they did unless they had their own motive and put people in place who could have assured the outcome of that trial, like one of our American infamous white paper committees, that you look at the committee membership and it's all a foregone conclusion what the decisions are going to be. The forum is yours.
Thank you, Gary. There are two reasons that Dr. Wakefield and his colleagues are being so viciously attacked. And as you've illustrated, the stakes are very high. The stakes are twofold. One is the social justice that we owe to children who we send into war against infection They are veterans. Some of those have come back fine, but some are injured. And we owe them a legal duty, a moral duty, to make sure that we have their backs in terms of making vaccines as safe as possible and that they receive appropriate compensation. So the motive for these completely unjustified attacks, all really originating with Brian Deer, who's more of a obsessive stalker and a blogger than he is a journalist. His funding has never been disclosed, and I think that's a good area for appropriate inquiry to see who's funding him. But the whole effort is to stop, first in the UK and now in the US, to stop appropriate legal inquiry into the basis of vaccine injury. We already know vaccines can cause autism. We know that from Professor Rutter in the UK, who reported a case in 1994 in the medical literature, well before Dr. Wakefield saw his first autistic child. We know that from the U.S. Vaccine Court, and the government has been conceding cases and losing cases in Vaccine Court of vaccine-caused autism since 1991. What we don't know is the number of children who are affected. The reason we don't know that, and this is the second answer to your question, is that there's never been a study ever comparing unvaccinated to vaccinated children, as there is with every other drug or medicine brought to market, to look at the exposure versus placebo to find out how safe and effective they are. That study has never been done. There's an ongoing study now, first ever, looking at infant macaques, monkeys, and you mentioned that in your listing of papers, that's found very serious differences between the vaccinated and unvaccinated monkeys. That's never been done in humans. And we've even gotten money in the budget to do that study, and CDC blocked it because they're terrified of the results if it shows a significant difference in the rate of autism in unvaccinated versus vaccinated children. The whole use of the vaccine schedule, which is now 38 vaccines by the time children are four, is an unethical mass social public health experiment because the basic safety science has never been done. It may turn out that vaccines are indeed quite safe, but it may turn out that there's a great deal of chronic illness caused by a vaccine, and even the public health authorities may say, well, we're saving measles deaths, we're trading that for autism. That's a choice that they may make behind closed doors at CDC. An individual parent offered that choice would say, no, I'm going to take the risk of getting measles because I don't want to take the risk of these adverse events. And the whole attack here is we need to have a safety-first agenda, which must begin with these safety studies, so that we do not send kids into war against infection without having their back.
Okay, let's go to the specific issues, if you would, please. I would like for you to go to the main issues and just give us your brief answer with documentation. The idea that Wakefield altered the data on the patient records and erased or changed the data.
Well, that accusation is preposterous on its face, especially coming from Deer, who's untrained in review of medical records, untrained in an autism diagnosis, and certainly untrained in how information is documented in all these files, and as you pointed out, didn't even have access to many of the files. The allegation is if it came on a blog, we just laugh at it and ignore it. The fact it has some credibility, it's published in the British Medical Association's journal, doctors in the UK are actually subsidized for giving vaccines in their local offices, and so there's sort of a financial motive there to make sure that vaccine safety isn't questioned. But in a way, you'd expect to see, if you take your child to the local doctor and he can't diagnose why your child is sick, you take your child to Sloan Kettering, and the experts there do different tests, more complete tests, and come up with a diagnosis, of course there's going to be a difference. That's the whole point. But you don't conclude from that Sloan Kettering has committed fraud. You conclude from that the local doctors weren't appropriately trained and were unable to discover this, what was then a very new bowel syndrome seen in autistic children. So that's why the British Medical Journal was so reckless, terrifyingly reckless in publishing these charges, because they reached the exact opposite conclusion from whatever differences there were in these diagnoses. The correct conclusion was the local doctors failed in their duty of care for these children, hence they had to get off to the Royal Free to see the specialists.
What would have been their motive to have brought these charges?
Two things. One is to defeat inquiry about vaccine safety, and two is to defeat the lawsuits against industry in the UK and in vaccine court here in the U.S.
All right. And finally, about the fact that Wakefield was just in it for the money.
Well, he sure didn't do a very good job. It's Deere's charges here are all over the map. Half the time he accuses Dr. Wakefield of being anti-vaccine, and half the time he accuses him of wanting to profit wildly from this new and mysterious vaccine. So Deere can't even get it right. As you just explained, the patent was for a treatment to clear infection from an infected bowel, certainly not a preventive vaccine, certainly one that would never have competed with MMR. He was paid as an expert witness, which is quite routine, and the government in the U.S. has hired 26 experts to defend industry, but we don't see anybody in the media going after their careers and going after the quality of their studies. One of their experts here in the U.S., Professor Michael Rutter, in fact, never discloses in his published articles that he was an expert in litigation. And he was actually the first doctor in the UK to describe a case of vaccine-caused autism in 1994, again, well before Wakefield ever came to the table. So it's routine, and in fact it's a duty of a doctor or a scientist to assist in sorting out these things in litigation. Usually these doctors are social heroes for helping in litigation. Dr. Wygant was famously had a movie about him called The Insider for helping in the tobacco litigation as a whistleblower. So normally this is a doctor's duty, a scientist's duty, when they uncover evidence of disease to aid the legal process in achieving social justice. So to condemn Wakefield and colleagues is in effect to deter any scientist or any doctor from coming forward to help expose problems in safety with medical products or drugs. So that's the basis for that attack.
All right, I appreciate that. I'm going to take an aside. By the way, for those of you listening, we'll be coming up in about 9 minutes to the end of this hour. We are continuing on. I have other guests. I have more material, and I have not yet even started to look at the challenges against the different vaccines on safety and efficacy, which we will do in detail with all supporting documentation on a vaccine initiative on my website, vaccineinitiative.com or progressiveradionetwork.com or garynull.com. They're in all places. I want to go back for a moment to the idea that here was a man who knew that vaccines he were given, and including the Sabin, was causing cancer, because they caused cancer in hamsters. And yet, in 1991, Maurice Hilleman told Merck that, hey, this mercury in the vaccines, it's not safe, there's all kinds of complications. The management chose to look the other way. That was an active choice. That was omission. Now, that then means that they knew, would have had to have known, that the autism and or injury, neurological injury, and if not autism, other neurological injury, and mercury was possible. And so finally, it was not until they were forced to explain why they didn't take this threat seriously when the memo finally did appear. And it was not for years and years later that they said that, oh, it was in a box of other documents. Now, it wasn't until 1999 that the CDC and the FDA recommended removal of mercury, quote, as soon as possible. Yet, in 2004, the CDC turns right around and says, oh, okay, but we're going to allow mercury in pregnant women's vaccine and babies 6 months or older, at completely dismissing all of the highly relevant science of the neurological dangers of mercury in those vaccines. And now when babies end up being damaged, or mothers damage, or mothers passing on some of that mercury, they then end up saying, oh, well, gee whiz, but we need more research. We don't need more research. What I believe we have is a systematic pattern of certain bureaucrats influenced by the pharmaceutical industry, which is heavily influencing our official public health policies, and then going after anyone that suggests there is any link to any condition from any vaccine ever. And I give you one example of that, the case of Dr. Linus Pauling, the only American ever to win two unshared Nobel Prizes. I knew Linus Pauling. He was a friend of mine. And when I was working as a scientist at the Institute of Applied Biology, he would come by when he was in town, and we would spend hours talking. And I remember when he said that he was going to be sharing information on vitamin C and quercetin in particular, stopping HIV replication, and how he believed that if the average American took 20,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day, throughout the day, that they could prevent a lot of diseases, help ameliorate a lot of conditions. And I said to him at that time, I said, you realize that they're going to go after you. He said, why would they do that? I said, because do you realize how much money is made on the very conditions that vitamin C would prevent or help? I said, do you think they're going to allow you? And he smiled. He says, well, he said, I've got 440 papers published in peer-reviewed journals, a tenured professor, emeritus, won 2 Nobel Prizes. I'm one of the most cited scientists in American history. I said, they will still destroy you. They destroyed Andrew Ivey, the most famous scientist in American history. They'll destroy you. He laughed. They destroyed him. Now, if you can destroy Linus Pauling's reputation, calling him a quack, a nut job, having the so-called quack busters that the New York Times and all these publications cite as experts and are experts in nothing, now that we have them in court, now that we're suing them, now that we're winning every single case and proving they're an expert in nothing, well, but the media doesn't cover that. Now, I'm going to play you in a second something very important. You're familiar with Dr. Luc Montagnier, the discoverer of the HIV virus, correct?
Yes.
You're also familiar that he won the Nobel Prize last year, not sharing that Nobel Prize with Dr. Robert Gallo, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You're also aware that Dr. Gallo was challenged for having stolen the HIV virus culture in his lab, and that went through a whole bunch of hearings, ethical hearings, at the time. You're aware of that?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You're also aware that it's almost never the case where two people involved in sharing something, they don't both share the Nobel Prize, right?
Yes.
So that really raises a lot. I'm going to play you now something extremely important, and I believe that this is two things. One, it's one of those Hilleman moments where the most important scientist in the history of AIDS comes around and says, we got it wrong, and an entire $500 billion cumulative up to this point industry, dwarfing heart disease or cancer, then turns around and is destroyed. I believe what he is saying now, you're going to hear it right now, will destroy the entire reputation. Mark my words how they go after him. Mark my words that Luc Montagnier will be looked upon now by people. I bet they've had dozens of meetings saying, what the hell are we going to do? Because this is going to affect all of our drugs and all of our money and our profit streams and all these foundations and all these organizations we give money to, who then act as attack dogs in the media for us and go after anyone who challenges as AIDS deniers. Yet this is the man that the entire industry rests upon. This, he created it. Linus Pauling didn't create vitamin C. Albert St. George won the Nobel Prize, did. They also attacked him. And I knew him, and I had him on my show. But this is the man who now says this. And mind you, this is exactly what one of the earlier articles I cited, oxidative stress leading to these conditions in people who've had the vaccines, and the vaccines causing extreme oxidative stress in the brain, in the intestine, leading to all forms of neurological damage. After all, what does mercury do? Massive oxidative stress. What do these wild viruses do? Massive oxidative stress. So here's what he says. Listen carefully. You have not heard this. You will not see this in any other media in the United States. Listen carefully.
You talked about oxidative stress earlier. Is treating oxidative stress one of the best ways to deal with the African AIDS epidemic?
I think this is one way to approach, to decrease the rate of transmission, because I believe HIV, we can be exposed to HIV many times without being chronically infected. Our immune system could get rid of virus within a few weeks if you have a good immune system. And this is the problem also of African people. Their nutrition is not very equilibrated. They are in oxidative stress, even they are not infected with HIV. So their immune system doesn't work well already. So it's prone, they can, you know, allow HIV to get in and persist. So there are many ways which are not the vaccine, the magic name, the vaccine. Many ways to decrease the transmission just by simple measures of nutrition, giving antioxidants, proper antioxidants, hygiene measures, you know, fighting the other infections. So they are not spectacular, but they could, you know, decrease very well the epidemic to the lower to the level they are in occidental countries,
so
Western countries.
If you have a good immune system, then your body can naturally get rid of HIV.
Yes.
Oh, interesting. Do you think we should have more of a push for antioxidants and things of that nature in Africa than antiretrovirals?
We should push for more, a combination of measures, antioxidant and nutrition, advice and nutrition, fighting other infections, malaria, tuberculosis, parasitosis, most children have worms. Education, of course, genital hygiene for women and men also. Very simple measure, which not very expensive, but which could do a lot. And this is my worry about the many spectacular actions. Of course, there are global funds so to buy drugs and so on, Bill Gates and so on, for the vaccine. But those kind of measures are not very well funded, not funded at all. Or they are, it really depends on the local government to take conscious of this, but local government, they take advice of the scientific advisor from the certain institutions, and they don't get this kind of advice very often.
There's no money in nutrition, right? There's no profit.
There's no profit, yes. Water is important. Water is key.
Now, one thing you said, you were talking about the fact that if you have a built immune system, it is possible to get rid of HIV naturally. If you take a poor African who's been infected and you build up their immune system, is it possible for them to also naturally get rid of it?
I would think so.
Okay. That's an important point.
It's important knowledge which is completely neglected. People always think of drugs and vaccine. So this is a message which may be different from the... what you heard before, no?
They're closing?
Yes, my message is different from what you heard from Fauci or...
Yes, it's a little different.
It's a little different.
There you have it. You have the man who just won the Nobel Prize in medicine for discovering the HIV virus stating for the first time that you've heard nowhere, that has not even been discussed in any television, radio, print medium, that if you take your antioxidants, you can prevent HIV infection. If you have a good diet, clean water, and medicines for traditional illnesses like malaria, if you're in Africa, or tuberculosis, you could reverse AIDS. Now, that is going to go directly into the profit picture of all of the official AIDS organizations that exist to make money off this. They've never cured a certain any person. Now watch to see what they do with Luc Montagnier, as they did with Linus Pauling, and I believe as they're doing with Andrew Wakefield. That's why I tied these in together, because we have to understand the power of the pharmaceutical industry. I will also be challenging a few other statements by Mr. Deere concerning the integrity of science, where he says, you can trust the science. And I'm saying, which science are you going to trust? And Richard Gale will be joining us in about a half hour to go through this. We're also going to show you what really reversed major illnesses. We will prove that it was not the vaccines. We look methodically. This took over 2 years of methodical research. We will actually print on our website today the charts, the public health charts showing you that before any vaccine was even invented for any condition, that condition was almost completely gone. So therefore, how can you, in any legitimate scientific way, offer the public the idea that you better take your vaccine because we'd still have smallpox or measles or polio or whooping cough because, we didn't have the vaccine? And we will show, no, you got it just backwards. The vaccine only occurred at the end of these conditions. So we will share that with documentation and the public health graphs and the scientific studies. But all this ties together. You simply have to see how it ties together. Now, we're going on to, we still have some other panelists to join us here. I'm having the existing panelists hang on board here because I want them to hear our next guest, our next two guests in a row. Let me just reiterate a few points here so we keep this in perspective. Up to this point in our 2-hour special, which will go into our third hour, We have referred to statements from Brian Deere that here's what's important. These documents that I have in my possession are significant. There is evidence that Brian Deere withheld from the General Medical Council trials in London of Dr. Andrew Wakefield and Professors Simon Murch and John Walker Smith. They are crucial evidence which shows these doctors were telling the truth that they did not have and were operating under ethical approval. I've cited those in detail. They were given to Brian Deere by the Royal Free Hospital London National Health Service Strategic Health Authority. And this shows the SHA knew the doctors had this ethical approval and were operating under this general ethical approval to take research biopsies during colonoscopy. The approval was in effect from at least 1995 to 2001 for all children who had biopsies taken. This means Brian Deere was on notice of this fact when he made his complaint to the General Medical Council. Now, withholding one is bad enough, especially February 1997, which was a crucial time. In Brian Deere's first formal written complaint to the General Medical Council on February 25, 2004, he stated he was, quote, acting under a duty. That duty would include disclosing all relevant material. One of the complaints of the defendants at the General Medical Council 2007 to 2009 trial was that documents relevant to their defense dating from the relevant time 1996-98 were missing. No, they weren't. Brian Deere had them, and the people knew what those were. That means, in my personal and professional journalistic observation, the people on that committee would have known that these documents existed. Now, withholding all might be seen as an attempt to pervert the course of justice, as together they supported the assertion put forward by a defense of operating under this approval, and that is important. So beyond that, it is up to us to weigh whether this was simply unethical or whether or not it met any of the challenges to being illegal. That is not for me to determine. That is for subsequent investigations. And I am going to ask this audience, if you feel compelled by the evidence presented in this special investigative report today on air, that is behooving upon us to ask that the highest officials in England open an independent inquiry into all of the allegations and also an independent inquiry challenging the British Medical Journal and all of the other official organizations that have been involved to come under oath and allow independent experts to come in, and I believe it will be a different outcome, and this may end up being one of the most embarrassing medical journalistic fiascos in history. Now let's go to my next guest, who is standing by, and I want to thank my other guests who have been on thus far, who have been sharing their insights and information with us. They have given us, each one, Mr. Moody has given us some very important insights. Mr. Miller has given us some insights. Now my guest is Dr. Edward Yazbak. He is a medical doctor. He is a board-certified pediatrician. For over 35 years, he is a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Since then, he is a medical expert for the Social Security Administration Office of Disability Adjudication and Review. He is a formerly assistant clinical director of the Charles Chapin Hospital and associate member of the Institute of Health Sciences at Brown University. And he is here to talk about this because his grandson is autistic and was treated at the Royal Free Hospital by Drs. Wakefield and Walker Smith. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Yazbak.
Thank you for having me, Mr. Nunn.
Dr. Yazbak.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Dr. Yazbak, I would like you to take some time now, if you would please, to talk about your own grandson, what you have seen in this entire matter up to this point, and being a board-certified pediatrician, and also having an academic background and a scientific background, tell us what your own independent observations have been. I believe yours was child number 8. And so if you could take us through what you saw and what your feelings are and what your research shows on anything in the scientific literature that would give you pause on the safety or efficacy of any vaccine, particularly the MMR vaccine. The forum is yours.
Thank you, Gary. I just want just a small correction. Our boy My grandson was not one of the 12, so he was not child number 8. He was seen later on our request, and I'll come to that. He was actually worked up after the paper had been written. Just to go back, is that I want to congratulate you for this show, but very quickly also, in children 3 to 5, we did not have any numbers for 1999-2000, but the first year we looked at those who had 15,581 3 to 5 year old children in the United States, in U.S. schools. That's in year 2000-2001, and they were age 3 to 5. Now these are age 3 to 5. This last year, 2009-2010, just reported 47,602, went up from 15,581 to 47,602. There we are as far as numbers of the atrocity of the thing, and here is one man who is trying to find an answer for all of this, and he's vilified, he's attacked, he's persecuted, he loses his country, he loses his license, and has crazy accusations against him that are off the wall, to say the least. I think, if I may, with your permission, I would like to just read a short statement by my daughter, the mother of the child. She is unfortunately in meetings all day today, and she cannot call you in person, but this is what she wrote. After banging my head against a wall with doctors on Harley Street and through the NHS, I was relieved when we finally got our appointment for the Royal Free. She was living at the time, by the way, in England with her son and her husband, and what struck me, she continues, what struck me was the depth of the history they took, both about Theo and our family. Dr. Mersch became one of Theo's favorite people. He loved going to the clinic for medical visits because they had great toys, and I think he sensed these doctors were really helping him. And he came to visit daily when we were on the gastro ward, where we had a special room, even with extensive care. During the colonoscopy, I was allowed to stay in the room with Theo. Before we went in, the intake was very elaborate. The nurse wanted to be sure that we had everything we needed, that we knew what to expect, etc. Dr. Mersch also walked us through everything a few times. We stayed longer for the colonoscopy, maybe 3 nights in all, because the team wanted to ensure that Theo was well established with the liquid elemental diet that he was to follow from there on. The nutritionist spent hours with me to discuss the elemental formula and also to talk about the gluten-free and casein-free diet that was going to follow. They did not scope Luca, who is the younger brother. They did not scope him because they felt confident they knew what they would find, given the family history. There was a time I came into the gastro ward, and Dr. Brent Taylor was there. I recognized him. I can recall double-checking his name tag to be sure. And then I couldn't resist asking him if he'd like to meet my son, if he'd like to meet a child who has developed completely normally until his MMR. I cornered him for 10 minutes asking him about the lack of data he had on the issue. When we finally went in to see Dr. Mersch for Theo's appointment, I was irate at the fact that he was in the gastro clinic after being so antagonistic to this research. Andy Wakefield is a hero in my book. I am so horrified at the misinformation and insanity that Brian Deere is promoting. As I have said before, if Andy were so wrong, why don't they just ignore him? And that's the end of my daughter's note to you today.
Okay, by the way, I also received an email just now from a physician, Heather. Quote, my holistic practice of 30 years has a great deal of client brainwashing to attempt to undo due to the huge Flagstaff Medical that would be in Arizona here. So many clients do come here after being told there's nothing wrong with them when they know there is something wrong, and then we deal with it here to solve the problems. It's amazing how so frustrating it is to try to re-educate people before they die or end up near dead in an ER. That's just one of the people who sent an email just now. And now, I want to read, you just read a letter from your daughter.
Yes, sir.
Now, I'm going to read a letter now from one of the individuals who was actually in the study and whose child was affected. And she has a completely different way of talking about this. And by the way, one of the people who challenged Brian Deere about being incorrect in the British Medical Journal, and I'll state this here, was, quote, I read with interest, your response. This is the British Medical Journal that about a week and a half ago, on January 19th, made a statement about how, well, you know, they want to have, quote, let's not curtail free speech. But here's what they say. This is the British Medical Journal, quote, I don't condone the flat earthers for one moment, but let's not advocate a society where their strident claims are censored before getting on the page. Surely the vacuous arguments being put forward in support of Wakefield's research illustrates precisely the point which Deere is making, unquote. Well, if the British Medical Journal starts off that anyone, no matter what their scientific background, chooses to challenge some aspect of the danger of vaccines or the fact that children are vaccinated and then do not all show symptoms immediately. I can show you children who didn't manifest a symptom until they were a year or two older, especially younger children, and then parents begin to see that their child is not developing in the same way other children are, because parents have to compare their child to other parents frequently and other parents' children. And then they see there's something wrong. Then will they have some form of learning behavior. They refuse to tie it back to the vaccines. So when we have dismissed the right of parents to act as advocates for their own children, as if they're not scientists, they're not doctors, but hold on a second. Isn't part of what being a good doctor to sit and speak with the parent and say, what have you observed? What is the basis of treating a patient? If a patient comes in to see you, and don't you say, what is your problem? And after giving them a therapeutic protocol, don't you ask them, how are you doing? You doing better, worse? Do we have to modify, to increase, decrease? That kind of intimacy between a patient and a physician is crucial to a proper outcome of that medical condition. The same should be true when a parent says, my child was normal until they got the vaccine, one or a combination, and suddenly they went into high fever, screaming, and then all these other neurological problems or gastrointestinal problems. If we discount all parents as being irrelevant, if we dismiss any critic, no matter what their background and academic standing is, quote, flat earthers and strident, if we say that they have no legitimacy, then what the British Medical Journal and by extension the British medical community and by extension the British government is doing is saying, we don't give a damn about you or your experience or your child's outcome because it doesn't match our preconceived notion that there can't be anything wrong with your child because we've already accepted there's nothing wrong with the vaccine. So if there's nothing wrong with the vaccine, then how could your child have a problem? So I think this kind of linear way of thinking is extremely disingenuous, and it goes against everything that good medicine and good science should be about. I'd like your thoughts on that, please.
Well, you're absolutely true. I mean, right about everything you've just said. I actually wrote a letter, my first letter to the BMJ about this trio articles that this gentleman published in, and I titled it "Whatever Happened to the British Medical Journal." I mailed it yesterday morning at 10. It has not been published to date, so I presume it's not going to be published. I only got an invitation to be on your show last night, so this was not anything. And in it, I made several observations. One of them is that of the rapid responses that are published, only the ones that are favorable to the article and to Mr. Deere are appearing. And if anyone dares, if there's from time to time someone who dares say that Wakefield is okay or that... And they're immediately accused of being anti-vaccinationist and given all kinds of labels. The other thing, observation that I made to the journal, is that I reviewed, and I couldn't find any time or any instance where the British Medical Journal, the official organization itself, ever approved of this article or wrote a supporting letter, or someone, the president of the BM, of the association, or anyone wrote to the journal saying, well, this is a wonderful series you have written. I have not seen that. I have also seen very few, if any, letters to the editor that were written by practicing British physicians. I saw a lot of things from scientists and zoologists and veterinarians and researchers, but I never saw anything from the physician. And I mean, I think their silence is quite important. The other thing is that, to the best of my knowledge, and I've been scouring all the British newspapers every morning at 4 when I get up, there is very little in the British press about these articles since they've been published, except for one newspaper. So there has been a total blackout. It seems like the only people who are interested to attack, to continue this attack are on this side of the Atlantic for some reason.
Final question for you. As a board-certified pediatrician, a scientist, and an academic, more has been done to support vaccines by children, of children, by pediatricians in any other single area of medicine. Do you believe that the pediatricians of America and the world should begin to pull back and take a real, honest, objective look at the safety and efficacy of vaccines to see if they may not be participating in something that could be harmful to some or many of these children?
Well, obviously, we are only reading, and I'm talking myself as a pediatrician too, and until I started looking at this, because my family was directly affected. And I can tell you, most pediatricians hear about the very good things that vaccines do, and that's what we get in medical journals. You don't get any criticism in medical journals. So they are all very favorable to vaccination. And by the way, I want to tell you that I am not anti-vaccine. I'm very much pro-judicious vaccination. I participated in statewide vaccination program. I participated in school vaccination. So, but I also, I have to tell you that until you get hit with a real serious vaccine injury in your family, that you start to think that, number one, I should let everybody decide for themselves. First, I should give them every information, both pro and con. And that's important. It's very important for pediatricians to give their patients the pros and cons and let them decide, except that the pediatrician himself knows very little about the side effects because they do not hear about them and they do not report them most of the time. And number two, they only hear about the positive things. So neither the pediatrician nor his office nor the patients who come into the office at this time are exposed to hear a balanced view of what's happening truly with all these vaccines. And that is the problem we face. And this is obviously it does not have much to do with poor Andy's situation, but which is really a horrible thing to have happened to this poor man who has done nothing but try to help kids.
Well, Dr. Yazbek, I have interviewed many, many physicians whose children developed autism, who one of these physicians actually gave her child the vaccinations and then realized only after she began to research that it was the vaccines, and then could not convince her colleagues or others that it was the vaccines. There seems to be a blind spot in this, and I've invited virtually all the panelists today are pro-vaccine. I did not want anyone assuming that I would have a panel with anti-vaccine. Virtually everyone from Dr. Wakefield and others, yourself, are pro-vaccine. So to show that even those in the pro-vaccine field can still be aware of the dangers of these vaccines. Thank you very much, Dr. Edward Yazbek, for being on today.
Thank you.
Now let's go over and say hello to Isabella Thomas. She has two autistic children who were part of the original 12 patients at the Royal Free Study reported by the Lancet and Dr. Wakefield's Marshall, Walker Smith and Merch and colleagues. And it is this 1998 study by Wakefield, subsequently retracted by the publication, that has caused such a fury over the MMR vaccine, and which is now the basis for the witch hunt against Wakefield in the UK. Isabella has four sons, two who received the MMR vaccine and are now autistic with serious bowel problems, and two sons who did not receive the MMR vaccine and are just fine. And nice to have you with us today, Isabella.
Hello, nice to be here.
Let me just cite a letter from one of the other parents that is important. It's short, and then we'll come back to you. I was one of the Lancet 12 mothers regarding the issue. I strongly believe, still believe, that the MMR vaccine was responsible for my son's condition. He was a lovely baby, developing normally, socially, emotionally, and intellectually. After his MMR, he regressed in all these areas. He became uncommunicative, unresponsive, antisocial. I was the only parent asked to appear at Dr. Wakefield's GMC hearing. I told the panel I wanted to put on the record that I had no complaint against Dr. Wakefield and his team regarding the treatment my son had received under their care. I also said I wanted it noted that my son and I had been treated with the utmost care and compassion at all times. I was told that the investigations were for research purposes and was fully informed what procedures would be undertaken. I was happy for these to go ahead in the hope that there would be help for my son and others. I believe Dr. Wakefield to be a concerned doctor who has the best interest of his patients at heart. I believe the GMC hearing was a tragic miscarriage of justice and abuse of power. The allegations made against Dr. Wakefield are wholly fabricated and bear little resemblance to truth. The GMC appeared to have taken no notice whatsoever of the parents who were actually involved in the research project, but instead have listened to an ill-informed journalist who has no knowledge at all of what occurred during those medical investigations. My child was not recruited. He was referred to Dr. Wakefield by my family doctor after she had spoken to him at length about his proposals for investigation and treatment. My son was seen as a result of medical need. As I have already said, Dr. Wakefield treated my son, and I, with the utmost concern, compassion, and kindness, he explained personally exactly what was going to happen and why. At no time did I feel either my son or I were being abused or manipulated. Dr. Wakefield never callous. Indeed, he was the complete opposite. And that was from Rochelle. Tell us your experience in concerning, first, Dr. Wakefield, secondly, Brian Deere.
All right. With Dr. Wakefield, he was fantastic. I knew about him through another parent who had said that there was a doctor looking at Crohn's disease and MMR vaccine. And so I phoned the Royal Free Hospital up out of the blue because I was so desperate. And I actually spoke to Dr. Wakefield. And for the first time ever, a doctor was listening to what I had to say. He just listened, and I must have been on the phone for a long, long time. And then he said to me that he's not my medical doctor. He can't advise me. But he did tell me that the Royal Free Hospital was the top gastro hospital in the UK. And so we had a long chat. He said that it would have to be up to my doctor if any referral was made. And so I saw my doctor and I had a long talk. And my doctor already knew about the study and he already knew about the Royal Free. And he was very, very concerned about Michael's symptoms as well as my youngest son. And he said that it would be in Michael's medical interest to be referred to the Royal Free under Professor Walker Smith. And that there was the study going on. And my doctor said he was very interested in this study because his son had autism and bowel problems. And I believe his son was being treated at the Royal Free. And so he was very interested in the study as well. So Michael was referred to Professor Walker Smith. Now, during the study, I did sign forms. Everything was explained to me absolutely properly. I signed for the ethical approval, everything. And with the procedures, the colonoscopy, I was there. So anything that was done with my son, I was in control. I was there. Everything was explained to me. And when I saw the damage in my son's bowel, I I had to come out, and I had mixed feelings because I knew I was vindicated, but being vindicated meant that you had to then believe your son had this awful bowel disease, and you didn't want to believe that. So, like I said, everything that went on at the Royal Free with the nurses, with the doctors, Professor Simon Murch, Professor Walker Smith, Dr. Wakefield, he was there. He didn't treat the children. He didn't do any of the tests, as Brian Deere wants everybody to believe that he was there, he was doing the tests, he was involved with the children. He wasn't in that way. He was on the research side. So, you know, that I must make that very plain with this. Now, as for Brian Deere, I was shocked and horrified when I saw his website, when I saw what he was putting on there. And I was shocked that he hadn't even looked at the Red Book or saw anything to do with my children. He didn't interview me, nothing like that. Now, he published on his website, 2004/5, he published the names of the children. It wasn't just their Christian names, as Brian Deere said on your program. He published the surnames of my children as well. Now, one thing I spotted
so are you
which
saying
concerned
that he,
me as well.
One second. Are
is
you
that,
Isabella, let's stop for a moment. Brian Deere very clearly stated, and the transcript shows, that when I asked him about publishing the names, he said he only published their Christian names. Are you saying that he misrepresented himself, that he did not just publish their Christian names?
No, he did not. I have the proof of that. He published the surnames of my children and some of the others. Not only that, he also published the when my children were invited to the hospital, on their appointment date to the hospital. Now, lawyers have said that there's no way he would have got that information from litigation, from the litigation, because that wasn't there. So he had the legal aid numbers, he had the dates my children were going to the Royal Free Hospital, and he had my children's full names. Now, on there, he made a mistake. So, I mean, I have to say that an informant has told me that Professor Tom MacDonald had given Brian Deere the children's medical records. Now, there was a big mistake where Brian Deere had put another child on as a Lancet child. Now, he had, when that child went into the Royal Free Hospital as well, he then corrected it and he put my son's name. So he, for one of my sons, he put another boy first. Now, how did he get hold of another child who was not part of that study? How did he get hold of his medical details? So he must have medical details of other children as well, which is absolutely shocking.
Is it legal?
Of course it's not legal. It really is not legal. Now, can I read this out?
Yes, read it out. But take your time, read it out. Let me just say, to Jane Hay Casey, quote, I have 12-year-old twins who have recovered from autism. If it wasn't for Dr. Wakefield, I would have never focused on making lacto-fermented foods to heal the gut inflammation. Thank you, Gary. Jane Casey, please continue.
Okay. This was sent to when I went to see my MP, and I complained to my MP about the medical records. And with this, and one of the expert witnesses for the litigation wrote to my MP as well on my behalf. And I'll read out because they've given me permission. I have a copy of the letter of complaint about breaches of confidentiality from an expert witness in the MMR litigation. It was sent by this expert witness to my own MP and to Alexander Harris solicitors who handle the UK MMR claims for the claimants. Now, I have permission to read this out. This is the expert witness. One of my roles as an expert witness in the MMR class action was to help collate information, including test results from various evidence collections for the court. I acted in good faith at the time on the clear understanding that any evidence pertaining to test results and related procedures would be held in the strictest confidence and disclosed only to those individuals or parties who had a legitimate role in the said litigation. Indeed, it was indicated to me at the time that any inappropriate disclosure of information outside the remit of litigation proceedings constituted a criminal act, which would place the person or persons in contempt of court and render them liable for prosecution. It has since become clear to me that several serious breaches of this confidence have occurred. Specifically, it is clear that Brian Deere has been given access to confidential research information, which is again referred to in the public domain via his website, in association with specifically named individuals who took part in a study having previously been assured of their confidential nature. This particular data to which I refer concerns measles virus genome screening of a group of case and controls. I was involved in unbinding these data and then holding the only copy of that data on my computer for several weeks. I can state with absolute confidence that these data were not made available by me to any other than Mr. Richard Barr, senior partner Alexander Harris, for the claimants. The doctor, and I can't give the name here, senior lecturer, claimant retained expert. Mr. Barr was obviously required to disclose the information contained in the data file to the legal teams representing the defendants in the litigation. Soon after he had done so, reference to detailed content of the data file appeared on Mr. Deere's website, naming individual control group children who had been involved. At no point were any names revealed in open court. It is therefore evident that Mr. Deere came by this information from outside the public domain. This is an appalling breach of confidentiality and potentially in contempt of court. Now, that's from one of the experts. Now, I have today emailed Mr. Justice Keith of the Royal Courts of Justice, and I have told him what Brian Deere said on your program yesterday, that he had the CDs or DVDs of the MMR litigation. It was given to him. I have asked Justice Keith to order Brian Deere to divulge who has given him this information. And I had a receipt from that saying that he would be, he would be looking into this. Now, I also have written, I don't know whether you knew about this, Gary, I wrote to Merck, and I wrote to them asking them, because what Merck has got on their website is where patients come first. That's their slogan. So I wrote to them asking them if I could have a meeting with them. I got a letter back from the president of Merck's vaccines. So she wrote, Merck Chairman Richard Clark asked me to respond to your letter since I am president of the Merck Vaccine Division. And then she says, it appears from references in your letter to the litigation about MMR vaccine that your two boys have been diagnosed with autism. While I do not have the first-hand knowledge that you do of the difficulties faced by parents with children with autism, to say nothing of those faced by the children themselves. Then she goes on to say she has friends with children with autism. And she says, I can appreciate the strong desire of parents to better understand the causes of autism. And then she says, I recognize that some have claimed that the MMR vaccine has caused autism. And she goes on to say that it has been thoroughly studied by many independent doctors. She said, here in the United States, one particular important example was the 2004 study. It says there was no evidence in favor of MMR and autism. She says, as you note, our website says that Merck is where patients come first. This is not just a slogan. This bit annoys me, I have to say, this bit that I'm reading to you now. Our products are rigorously tested before license, and Merck continues to evaluate safety after the product is brought to market. She says, Merck vaccines have been tremendously helpful in disease prevention worldwide. She goes on to say, while I do not believe that a meeting would be fruitful, and I believe it would be myself, but there she says it wouldn't, I hope you know that this is not a standard letter, form letter, and that we indeed thank you for reaching out to us, because nothing is more important to Merck than the safety of our medicines and vaccines. So basically, she's telling me, I don't want to meet you, I'm not interested in your children, and I'm not interested in what's happening to other children. It's just a standard letter. I think it's absolutely appalling.
Isabella, one of the things that I commissioned 2 years ago, and I brought in a group of special investigators, is I gave them the assignment, find me how many pharmaceutical companies engaged in vaccine production have been found guilty, paid fines, and acknowledged guilt, and how many patients were damaged or killed. What I was surprised by is we broadened it out to all pharmaceuticals, and it ran into the hundreds of thousands of cases and lawsuits, into the hundreds of billions of dollars. And crimes such as falsifying data, price fixing, hiding information that would have given a different view of a particular drug. So what we're dealing with is an industry-wide, that has a history of serial offenses, and yet the American media and the British media have started off with the fact that the industries producing a pharmaceutical are clean without any blemish to their background, wrong. That the drugs are safe and effective or they wouldn't be used, wrong. And that if something does go wrong, it couldn't possibly be the cause of the drug or the person giving it or the manufacturer. It must be just misinterpretation of the condition by the patients, wrong again. So that's why we have to look at the broader context. Now, we are going to continue this program. I have one of the most important parts still to come, where I'm going to go through some of the actual scientific peer-reviewed literature to prove our point. But I want to see what else that you have to say, having communicated with other parents, concerning the idea that the British media should have started with the parents and their personal observations. Because if you have a statement, a claim, if you have legal documentation that a physician or other physicians engaged in fraudulent behavior to manipulate patients, to abuse those patients for their own financial gain, then you start off with the patients. And if the patients confirm that, yes, this doctor lied to me, this doctor manipulated me, my child is worse because of this, we were used, then the media is in a least responsible way of taking those statements about the parents and the effect upon their children. And then they tie that in with the investigation and the outcome of any legal proceedings. That has not happened. And I'm curious, I want you now to take us on this trip. Why is it that the most important people in this entire hearing have not been interviewed? Yourself included,
and all the other parents. A lot of journalists, and I said to them, why are you not doing something about this now? Why is there such a silence? And I was told that when it gets to the editor's desk, it's dropped. I was told that a D notice is put on it. That means it's a government notice. I'm assuming it's government, where they say that if you start telling the stories of the parents, you will create widespread panic, and the panic will stop parents wanting vaccinations. One journalist told me they were hauled up to Downing Street and told to back off. And that is what we're up against. I get phone calls from parents constantly. They are desperate. Their children are so sick. The stories, I've had letters from parents, and the stories are all consistent, and they don't know each other. and they are so desperate. And you know what makes me so upset? And I know I shouldn't take this on myself, but when I see a child still being damaged today by the MMR vaccine or any other vaccines, I think, my God, I wish I'd done more. Why, after all these years, are they still damaging children? It should have been stopped. You know, you need to have a look at the licensing of the MMR vaccine. You need to see that the license came in on the MMR vaccine with a different rubella in it. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff that needs to be looked at. Batches are withdrawn. Merck's own factories in America, they were fined because of the factories were dirty. I've seen documentation on that. So we need independent panel of experts. We need people that are not bought by the drug companies, that are not associated with the government, and they need to be the ones looking at safety of vaccines and protecting our children, protecting babies. And that's not happening. That is not happening at all.
Have you discussed with the parents getting together and making a statement, holding a protest, and in front of the, let's say, the British Medical Journal office, or in front of...
That's an idea. What we've done is we've marched to Downing Street. We've handed a protest letter into Downing Street. I got a reply from Downing Street, and it's just a standard reply, literally. My son did a petition, and it's still going, the Nigel Thomas petition, with thousands of signatures on there from medical profession as well. And so we handed that into the my son handed it into the GMC, and I doubt whether any of the people on the panel have seen that. So, you know, parents have stood outside the GMC. They've had banners. We've had marches. The media don't turn up to the marches, so nobody knows these are going on. We have done a lot. And one thing is, we are very strong. We're like a family together now. We've done this now for so many years. And, you know, we phone each other up when the children are so sick. We try and help each other out. And thank God we have got each other. But, you know, parents then, there's a lot of parents whose children are so sick, they can't come out to march. They're worn out. They're fighting the education system. They're fighting, it's not just what's happening on the vaccine side. They're carers. They're looking after their children. They're frightened to know what's going to happen when the children are older. Who's going to look after them? So, you know, it's a constant battle with the parents. And a constant battle with the medical profession as well.
I understand. But at some point, if you work together with the children and the parents to hold a demonstration outside of your high court building, and then the next day in front of Parliament, and the next day in front of your Department of Justice.
We did Parliament, and we were there all night, all day with placards. When MPs were going by, we were talking to them. So we did do that as well. But again, no media, whether they were banned from coming to see us, there was no real interest in that. You know, it's very hard. You know, you can start shouting, you can start, parents have done it individually too, with placards. We had photos of our children. Like I said, we were outside the GMC as well. So we have fought a lot. We're campaigning very hard in the UK. We really are, and we will do it until the day we die.
I would suggest you also continue to approach the BBC and other places. Let me give you a little background on the BBC, which, in my opinion, is one of the finest broadcasting networks in the world. But they had a glaring blind spot at one point. There was a documentary that was produced called Go Climb the Mountain. It was based upon the work of Dr. Joseph Issels, the leading alternative or complementary doctor on cancer in Europe. Dr. Issels was a board-certified surgeon by training, but he also realized that there were other ways of helping a person with cancer, and he broadened himself and worked outside of the normal paradigm. And in so doing, he was able to help more people with terminal cancer than any other physician in the world. And this was independently confirmed by Dr. Audier of Leiden University. A 17% cure rate with terminal cancer. In the United States and Britain, it's zero. And a non-relapse rate of 87%. Again, far beyond anything in either the United States or Great Britain. A Gordon Higginson was a part of this whole effort. In that time, there was a man named Aubrey who was the head of the BBC in that division. When the documentary was completed, and they went around the world tracking down all of Joseph Issels' patients that he had worked on over a number of years, and only speaking with those patients who had had terminal cancer, diagnosed and treated elsewhere, but then failing that therapy, came to him at death's door. And now, years later, they're alive and well. After independent confirmation, by reaching these people wherever they were in the world, they went forward with the documentary. At that point, the BBC was going to schedule it, and then held it off. Why? Because the pressure brought, as my investigation would later show, by members of the British medical community. And why would they hold it off? Well, one man in particular, whose private notes I was able to get my hands on and confronted him, showed that it was just something he couldn't believe, even though these people went there to see for themselves. So it wasn't as if Issels was hiding anything. He hadn't promised anyone cures. His 50,000 files were open for complete scrutiny. They just couldn't accept the fact that this German was doing something they, in the United Kingdom, had not been able to do. There was a Professor Anderson from London College who led that particular expedition, and I interviewed him at length when I went to England. And then it was Gordon Higginson who really, to his credit, as one of England's greatest journalists, managed to bring pressure upon this. And finally, they didn't air it in England. They aired it in another country. I think it was Denmark. And anyhow, that caused a public uproar in the media. So the media said, well, what is this cancer cure that other countries are talking about? What we're not talking about in the United Kingdom, even though they were the ones who confirmed it. And that brought pressure, so much pressure on the BBC, they finally had to air it. It turned out that became the most successful and watched documentary in BBC history up to that time. And then that opened the can of worms. That is not uncommon. So to suggest that everything that is right and true and scientific will be explored openly and objectively within the United Kingdom is simply there is a history showing just the opposite, that you have as much individuals interceding where there is a conflict in ideology, a conflict in politics, a financial conflict, as we do or any other country does. This is not unique. It happens in Italy, France, Germany, and the United States. It happens in the United States all the time. And Richard Gere will be talking about that in a few moments. So I just wanted to give you some offering of support that at some point, some journalist, either in the BBC or Channel 4 or some other paper, The Guardian, which is a very good paper, The Independent, someone will begin to take your group and their findings seriously and open up, as we have, our own independent investigation. And which time, I'm sure that they will also see, at the very least, that even respecting Brian Deere's capacity to do his own research, I have not challenged, would not challenge his character, his veracity, as a journalist, but I do challenge the correctness of his assertions and his conclusions, as I do the British Medical Journal and the British Medical Commission. So please realize that you are going to find someone at some point to do the right thing and do an independent, open investigation.
Sorry to interrupt you. There was a documentary. These were serious people who did documentaries for BBC, for different companies, and they approached me. And they asked me if I would start searching and interviewing top scientists, etc., to do with my children. So we did a lot of that, and they approached BBC, they approached everybody to air this documentary, and there's some quite powerful stuff on it, and everybody refused. Not one in this country would, put the documentary on. So that's what we're up against.
Okay, but understand, that's the orthodox media. It's no different than my documentary on Gulf War Syndrome killing our own, or fatal fallout about our failed nuclear policy, or the drugging of our children. But if you looked up on Google, it was the second most watched documentary in the world on Google, and we had millions of people watch it. So there are other venues. If you would have that gentleman, or whoever it was who did the documentary, send it to my New York office. I'll be happy to see about putting it up on our website, where millions upon millions of people can watch it, and thereby, therefore not being limited by the influence of pharmaceuticals, companies, or politicians on censoring what goes on in the media. All right?
I'll put you in touch with the producer.
Isabella Thomas, thank you. I'm going to ask all of our guests, Jim Moody and Clifford Miller, Dr. Edward Yazbek, and Dr. Andrew Wakefield, to stay put for a few minutes. We're coming up near the end of our program, but we still have about another 15 minutes because we're now going to take a careful look at what underlies everything. Are vaccines safe and effective? We've been told yes, and there's no question. Until there is a question, and we're questioning. Because we happen to believe in the veracity of parents, millions of parents, and their children having been adversely affected, and the media and the mainstream medical community not giving these parents the respect and attention that they deserve. Let us now go into our studio in New York City. We're standing by is one of our scholars in residence and executive producer of Progressive Radio Network and my program, Richard Gale. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good. Richard, we're going to have all of our panelists have their final say.
Okay.
Final closing arguments after we go through this issue. And you have the documentation there. You have posted the documentation. On GaryNall.com, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, and VaccineInitiative.com. Let us now take the issue. Here are the questions I'm going to offer you. Please answer them with documentation. Everything we're about to say can be fully, fully supported. We've been told vaccines are safe and effective, and that they are the cause for the eradication of smallpox and other major plagues. The forum is yours.
Okay, I'd like to address one issue that's direct, and I think this is very important for the listeners to hear, because vaccines stimulate the immune system, and a lot of people do not quite understand what that means. When we hear of these safety and efficacy studies, these studies are monitoring one of, and just very general, just for the layperson, but they're stimulating one of two major immune systems that are being monitored. And one of those systems, we call it the humoral immune system, or the antibody. So a person gets a vaccine, and there's an immediate response, and there's the measuring of an antibody that is being generated to combat the virus that's being introduced to the body. These are immediate responses. So consequently, what we find is that these safety studies and efficacy studies will only last 14 days or 3 weeks or something. But there's another immune system, which is the cellular immunity. This has nothing to do with an antibody. This is concerns the macrophages of the body, our T cells, or the natural killer T cells, the cytotoxic T lymphocytes and cytokines. This is a much longer process to be monitored in a proper way to see whether there are long-term latent effects or adverse effects from a vaccine. These are not being monitored. So to just quickly, under that, looking at that, what are some of these latent long-term effects? And one has been, we've heard of the Haemophilus influenza vaccine, commonly known as HIB. And the largest study ever done, and this involved well over 200,000 people, two groups. It was performed in Finland. There was 116,000 which had received four doses of the HIB vaccine over the course of time, and then our control group of 128. But they did follow-ups on this, on the children in this. And what they discovered through the study was that the group that was receiving the vaccines, there was a huge increase in insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus. Now, diabetes is related to is an autoimmune issue. So we're and we posted one of our studies that we posted on GaryNull.com and the Vaccine Initiative, where we I found documentation showing the cytokine pattern to the onset of diabetes that has not been shown before. And in fact, in my research, I also found some of those same cytokines related to diabetes onset and for the some of the GI adverse effects that that Dr. Wakefield is referring to. They share some of the same cytokines when a measles vaccine is introduced into the body. But we don't see this being looked at by any of the of our federal officials, health officials at all. There was a doctor, some doctors, Cohn and Schoen. Now they raised this whole introduction of latent onset of diabetes, and even with autism and enterocolitis syndrome as well with the MMR vaccine. And Dr. Wakefield, in an additional study that was performed in 2001 with Scott Montgomery, and he had published this in the Adverse Drug Reaction and Toxicology Review, it again raised this whole issue of long-term latent onset of the autism and enterocolitis syndrome that was related to the MMR vaccine. And that was a study that, to my understanding, was actually reviewed by four of the leading British authorities, and of whom had previously held positions in the regulation and licensing of medicines in the UK, and they supported that article. We find so those are a couple examples, but I think the issue being that there is no monitoring for safety and efficacy of vaccines related to latent adverse effects that are related associated with the cellular immune system. They're only looking at the antibody immune system, and that's what they do, because this is how they say, oh yes, there's a good antibody response to this vaccine, so therefore it's going to be effective. Then there's the other question, is how effective are vaccines, and this is becomes a historical question, because we have to look back into time and see, look at the different statistics on the rise and fall of infectious rates in populations. And the documentation and the statistics, these go back to the 1850s. There's figures. And when I mention some of these figures to listeners, what's important to remember, even though you're going to observe, even before the vaccine was introduced to a population, there was a dramatic decrease in infectious rates and mortality rates. But put that also in the context, especially with the United States, a rapidly growing population size. To say, for example, for the pertussis mortality, going back to 1918, when there was, almost 16,000, 16,000 deaths from pertussis. By the time that the pertussis vaccine was introduced to the American population around 1948, it had decreased, with these charts, it decreased to approximately around 1,500. But when we look at the population increase in size from 1918 to 1948, after World War One and the mass immigration from Eastern Europe into the U.S. and from other countries, those figures even become all the more important before the introduction of pertussis.
Richard, I have the same figures and the same charts that you're working from. Here's what it shows: that virtually every single major illness that has been a cause of major suffering and death that has a vaccine associated, the vaccine came in at the very end of that death cycle. Anywhere from 90 to 98% of the people who were dying were gone before the vaccine even came in, which means that the disease had worked itself out. There was no longer an epidemic. It was down to almost nothing. And so, therefore, to give 100% credit is wrong at every level of science and public health. It was better nutrition, more variety of nutrition, better standards of housing, cleaner water, pasteurization of milk, opening up roads to get people to be able to get into and out of the cities, not burying people in the city, not drinking straight out of the river waters, better sanitation. Remember, there's a time in England where there were no bathrooms in any houses. People would defecate in a bucket and throw it out the window. They were out in the street, and people were supposed to clean this. This meant that there were enormous amount of viruses that can cause illness. People did not have clean hands, clean sanitation, clean water. And when they did get these services, when we began to see major shifts in public health initiatives, that's when people began to see a decline in these major illnesses. In fact, with the largest number of deaths in history since it was recorded after the vaccine, it was in those who were vaccinated for smallpox. And Jenner's work, the man who invented it, was considered the father of vaccination. His own son died. The young man that he was working on that was given all the credit for, look what we did. We gave this guy cowpox and then injected smallpox into his scabs into his cut arm. And lo and behold, he didn't die of smallpox. No, he became deathly ill. Many other physicians at the time were arguing that this was nonsense. There have been many people who had cowpox, got smallpox, and died of smallpox. So Jenner's entire basis was flawed, and he did not have any studies, just this one person, but he had a very rich sponsor in Parliament, and that's how he bought his medical degree. So when you look at this, it is a terrible notion of bad science. Now, we've reported on this. We have the charts up on our website. And also, we have taken the studies that show that large numbers of people, including recently, who came down with whooping cough or came down with measles, were fully vaccinated. Well, here's the issue. If you have one child, one single child that you can show developed any form of autism from a vaccine, then you've made your point. Mm-hmm. It's like all the scientists in America and the bioengineers in America said that no human body could run faster than 4 minutes until Bannister broke the four-minute mile, 358, I think it was 1958, and suddenly they were all wrong. All you have to have is one that establishes the principle, and then from that, then others expand out. So they've tried to keep this from getting out. And in a few moments, I'll show you how wrong they were by our own court's actual statements on the record. And it's interesting how Brian Deere or others cannot find the information that's a matter of official record showing the autism vaccine connection. Now, how we interpret that after it's been published is each person's prerogative. But you can't dismiss the fact that it is a connection. So now we have multiple connections between autism and environmental factors and vaccines. But they've tried their damnedest, as we know from the Simpsonwood conference, to intentionally, with malice aforethought, cover this up. How do we know? Because Robert F. Kennedy Jr., through a Freedom of Information Act, got the actual document. No one knew at the time when they were sitting around the FDA, the CDC, and the World Health Organization, and the heads of the vaccine divisions of all major manufacturers went to this North Carolina retreat and talked about, gee whiz, there's this major study that just came out, and it shows a connection between vaccination and autism. What are we going to do about it? Well, in point of fact, what they did in many people's minds is manipulating scientific data. Now, that's a federal offense. And yet, as we've seen historically, it is the interpretation of the Attorney General's office whether or not they want to choose to prosecute it or not. And we have many crimes and misdemeanors in the United States that are not prosecuted, including the lies in the United States and the lies in England that got us into these wars. And ask those journalists who've done their homework in the United Kingdom, do they believe that Tony Blair and his administration were telling the truth, or did they succumb to the manipulation or the pressure from Washington to get us into that Iraq war? And same in the United States. I don't believe that it was they got faulty intelligence. The documentation, for those of us who've done the research, shows that they created their own documentation that supported going to war, and they had every intention of going to war, and there are documents that prove that. Therefore, they are susceptible to crimes against humanity and violation of major treaties, which could mean that they could be held accountable. But you have to have someone in power who's willing to say, you are going to go to trial. Well, we don't have that. We don't have the political will, nor do we have those individuals who are willing to do it. Because if you do it against the Republicans, you're also going to have to equally do it against the Democrats. So these issues are as much political as they are economic. And but is the actual science there? And I will show in a moment that it is. I will also show that if you have people who are fully vaccinated coming down with the illness from which they were supposed to be vaccinated, then you cannot, by any measure of good science or reason, say, oh yeah, you individual will be safe from any harmful effects of the vaccine, you'll be protected. Now, if you doubt me, ask any physician anywhere in the world, will you sign a legal statement that if I am injured or if I'm not protected from this vaccine, you will personally pay for the damages? Let's see if any physician's willing to do that. Or better still, why don't we ask the government? If a government is willing to sign that any vaccine that we mandate, any vaccine that we help support the use of, like the H1N1 or the flu vaccine, that if there's any injury, we will protect you. They have done everything possible to deny people proper access even to get covered by having artificially short deadlines. A lot of people don't fall with symptoms inside the immediate deadlines. So government's not willing to be responsible. Corporation's not willing to be responsible. And where if you take a chemotherapy agent and you are sick and you can sue the manufacturer. If you take a heart disease drug and you're sick and you can Prozac, you can sue. Why is it that the only people you're not allowed to sue, the manufacturers, are the vaccine companies? Because they got the political, they had the political power on their side to realize how vulnerable they were because of how bad their science was. And that is what is not being discussed. And that's where journalists self-censor. If you know, as my guest just said, Isabella Thomas, that a journalist wants to tell the truth, but what is the likelihood that they're going to go up against some official who's going to say, you shouldn't have come against us? Then you look at what you're going against. You're going against not just manufacturing companies. You're going against the most powerful corporations in the world, the wealthiest corporations in the world. Their wealth dwarfs that of ExxonMobil. You're going against the highest percentage of profit over their generic manufacturing of any product in the world. You're also going against those companies that have been smart enough to create front groups, foundations, think tanks. They then hire people, including consultants, of which there are over 44,000 consultants in Washington alone, that are former legislators or former National Institutes of Health directors. We've seen the revolving door, people going from the FDA into the pharmaceutical industry, not just that, but going in to head their vaccine division. So that means that they know who they can rely upon to be a team player and all speak with the same voice. Vaccines are safe and effective. There is no connection between vaccines and autism. And yet, the science shows just the opposite. Any thoughts from you on this before we go back just to our final panel and I give my final summation?
Just a couple examples, the listeners can have a kind of a greater appreciation. Centers for Disease Control, it's their own data from the MMWR, a study 2006 looking at the mumps outbreak in Iowa. 92% of those among those that contracted mumps, 92% were vaccinated, 8% unvaccinated. 2004 in Journal of Pediatrics, a similar study done in Oregon for the chickenpox outbreak statewide. 86 were vaccinated that contracted the smallpox, while only 14% were not. And of course, there's the issue that there may be more people being vaccinated. Pertussis, this was an Ohio 2008 study from CDC official surveillance data. For pertussis, 90% were vaccinated that came down with pertussis, while 10% were unvaccinated. And just one more for a measles outbreak, looking through Texas, this is a little earlier in the 87 New England Journal of Medicine, 99% of those who contracted measles were vaccinated, only 1% unvaccinated. So that kind of, I think those kind of figures kind of would lay the efficacy ideology to rest. Okay, Gary?
Yes, sorry, just lost a connection. Okay, now, thank you for that, Richard. Now, before we go to our final wrap-up of our panelists, and I will ask people in this audience who have suggestions, thoughts on what we've been doing in what is one of the longest radio special investigative reports in American history to call us. I'm going to give you our 800 number now. So anywhere in North America, you can call 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I want to thank the people who are standing by. We have people from all over the world, according to our research right now online. All of our panelists are standing by. Now for my own closing thoughts on this. And by the way, we have tremendous amount of documentation on vaccineinitiative.com, progressiveradionetwork.com, and GaryNall.com. Central to the latest claims by the gentleman I had on, journalist Brian Deer, published in the British Medical Journal, 6th of January, is the allegation that Dr. Wakefield, quote, altered numerous facts about the patient's medical histories in order to support his claim to have identified a new syndrome, unquote. What Deer, in my opinion, and the British Medical Journal failed to point out, is that not only did Wakefield not produce the results, the work of those results were of 12 other specialists at the Royal Free Hospital, London, England. All of those individuals had meticulous backgrounds. Not one had ever been involved in any controversy, ever a fraud. They had published cumulatively over 1,000 articles in peer-reviewed journals. What Deer and the British Medical Journal failed to research is that it was not possible for Dr. Wakefield or anyone else to falsify the prior clinical records of the children because no one at the Royal Free Hospital had them, nor is it normal practice for them to have had them. So then my question is, where is the fraud? Where is the, quote, altering, unquote, unquote, those histories? It simply was not possible. Also, Mr. Deer's claims focused on what he says to be discrepancies between the clinical medical histories taken at the Royal Free Hospital and the National Health Service's general practitioner and other records of the child patients concerned taken over some years by various different family doctors. Well, what I believe the British Medical Journal fails to make clear is that it is extremely common and normal practice that records were not provided to the Royal Free team. Why? Because the doctors wanted to start fresh by taking their own medical records because they were the specialists, not the GPs, the general practitioners. And also, it was only with a referral level letter from a patient's family doctor setting out relevant prior clinical history. A child's history is taken from accounts given by the parents. So if the parent is the one sitting at the Royal Free Hospital in long discussions about their children's problems, they're doing so with the Royal Free team of 12, including Andrew Wakefield making 13. So therefore, what we have is we have the parents who are the ultimate observers, the first person observers, the most important observers saying, here's what my child has. It is not the previous general practitioners who could not find the reason for them having these gastrointestinal disturbances or other disturbances. It is that's why they went to see the specialist. Where a history is taken from a parent, it is common for that parent to be unaware of what a general practitioner may have entered prior in their records. So that is important to understand. Those records and notes, which can be created over years by numerous individuals, may not be reliable, hence the need to start fresh. The Royal Free diagnoses were made independently and new by specialists in their fields who would not rely on prior diagnosis by GPs for obvious reasons. Further, The role-free clinical histories were taken not by Dr. Wakefield, as Brian Deere has been led us to believe, but by the then world-leading gastroenterologist Professor John Walker Smith, who was also accused and found guilty by the General Medical Council and who's appealing to the English High Court. Over and above all this, as no parent was called by the General Medical Council prosecutor to the GMC hearings, bar that one who thought the evidence was given for the defendant's benefit, there has been no opportunity for the parents to answer Mr. Deere's allegations or to challenge what he says, nor has there been any proper full independent investigation of these cherry-picked allegations, nor any opportunity for any claims now being made to be subject to cross-examination and independent investigation. Additionally, there has been no independent review of Mr. Deere's sources and materials by an independent outside investigative reporting body. Additionally, one of the witnesses in the GMC proceedings against Dr. Wakefield, writing to the British Medical Journal, confirmed the validity of the histopathology on which the paper was based and illustrated on how the Sunday Times journalist, Brian Deere, had misrepresented her evidence. Dr. Susan E. Davies, consultant histopathologist, Addenbrooke Hospital, Cambridge, stated in the British Medical Journal regarding the British Medical Journal article by Brian Deere that, quote, "There is some misrepresentation and lack of understanding of the process and studies involving histopathology. While clinical gastroenterologists might consider active inflammation with incipient crypt abscess formation to be normal in children, this is a significant finding to be recorded by pathologists," unquote. "Caution in assessing histopathological opinions," unquote. The other, therefore, challenging the veracity of Brian Deere. The other significant flaw in these statements is that if the paper was a fraud that they wrote, how is it that the findings are now being accepted in other scientific publications? Nowhere is this made clearer than in the U.S. National Autism Association's news release, the 5th of January. And in summary, what the National Autism Association states in their U.K. news release is that if the 1998 Lancet paper's results were faked, how is it that now Wakefield's work is being investigated by others and seen to be associated? The U.S. federal court has ordered substantial compensation for children whose autistic conditions were caused by vaccines. And let's get into some of these specifically. Now, we also have to understand that by three U.S. federal court decisions, Pauling, Zeller, and Banks, that vaccines have been proven to be causative in vaccine condition. These are in addition to 1,322 cases of serious brain injuries and medical conditions caused by vaccines, which the U.S. Admits compensating. It is troubling that children susceptible to serious vaccine injury are not being screened out of the vaccine programs, and nothing is being done to save such children. Now, it is a matter of scientific reality that many children and many adults have pre-existing conditions that should exempt them from vaccination, and yet no one is exempted from vaccination. Everyone who wants to get a vaccine anywhere, at any of the pharmacies or your doctor's office or hospital, can do so. There's no history taken, so therefore we're not even practicing the basis of which we already know. In fact, one of the latest medical research, including a January 2010 pediatrics, and by a substantial body of prior peer review papers showing that autistic children have substantially higher rates of bowel disease than other children. Now, this published medical evidence confirms the earlier report in the Lancet Medical Journal in 1998 by the 13-strong team of medical experts from the international renowned Royal Free Hospital in London of Wakefield. Also, Wendy Foriner of the U.S. National Autism Association states, quote, "Despite mounting scientific evidence worldwide confirming the presence of serious bowel disease in some children diagnosed with autism and evidence of a causal association with vaccines, health officials and medical professionals internationally continue to spin, deny, and suppress the evidence. This latest attack by the U.K. medical profession through a journalist who apparently has no source of income besides stories about Andrew Wakefield, is a continuing denial and failure to investigate either the contrary evidence that exists or the clinical histories of millions of children currently diagnosed with autism worldwide. Unquote. 1 in 64 British children and 1 in 110 children in the United States are now diagnosed with autism. Quote, increasing rates of autism in children are out of control. Despite this pandemic, health officials and medical professionals continue to bury their heads in the sand while children and families suffer. The link between vaccines and the development of autism in susceptible individuals is not going away because the children are not going away. Unquote. That was also from the same source, Ms. Fournier. Now, public statements by U.S. agencies and officials confirming autistic conditions are caused by vaccines, and there are many. The current president of Merck's vaccine division, Julia Gerberding, confirmed vaccines can cause autism in CBS News when she was director of the U.S. Vaccine Oversight as part of the U.S. Public Health Service, and that had a large buzz, and also the U.S. for Center for Disease Control, I should say, in relation to the case of Hannah Pauling. That was a 9-year-old girl awarded $20 million in compensation in 2010 over her lifetime for autistic conditions caused by 9 vaccines administered in one day. And therein lies the whole concept of Bannister breaking the 4-minute mile. If you have one child that it can be independently confirmed injuries were caused through vaccine that related to autism, then you establish the principle. Quote, here's what she said. Now, we all know that vaccines can occasionally cause fevers in kids. So if a child was immunized, got a fever, had other complications from the vaccines, and if you're predisposed with the mitochondrial disorder, it can certainly set off some damage. Some of the symptoms can be symptoms that are characteristics of autism. Unquote. Also, under House Call with Dr. Sanjay Gupta, Unraveling the Mysteries of Autism, talking with the CDC director, Stories of Children with Autism, Aging and Autism, aired March 29, 2008, quote, a new paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association confirms, contrary to U.S. public health claims, that mitochondrial dysfunction is not rare, but common in children like 9-year-old U.S. girl Hannah Pauling. We're more likely to have mitochondrial dysfunction, mtDNA over-replication, and mtDNA deletions than typically developing children, unquote. Now, Mitochondrial Dysfunction and Autism, Journal of the American Medical Association, Volume 304, page 2389. This can occur also be confirmed in a peer-reviewed medical journal about Hannah Pauling's condition in the Journal of Child Neurology, which states, quote, young children who have dysfunctional cellular energy metabolism, therefore, might be more prone to undergo autistic regression between 18 and 30 months of age if they have infections or immunizations at the same time. Now, developmental regression and mitochondrial dysfunction in a child with autism, the Journal of Child Neurology, Volume 21, Number 2, February 2006, it was conceded by U.S. officials that Hannah Pauling had a mitochondrial dysfunction. That autistic conditions can result from vaccination were confirmed by the U.S. Health Resources and Service Administration to Cheryl Atkinson of CBS News in relation to 1,322 cases of vaccine injury compensation settled out of court by the U.S. governments in unpublished settlements. Quote, we have compensated cases in which children exhibited encephalopathy or general brain disease. Encephalopathy may be accompanied by medical progression of an array of symptoms, including autistic behavior, autism, or seizures. Unquote. Vaccine case, an exception or precedent, first family to have autistic-related case, conceded is just one of thousands. CBS News by Cheryl Atkinson and Washington, March 6, 2008, and it should be noted that the U.S. government admits to compensating 1,322 children who develop very serious medical conditions following brain damage caused by vaccines. Dr. Bernadette Healy, a former director of the U.S. National Institutes of Health, responsible for their $30 billion annual budget, states, quote, I think the public health officials have been too quick to dismiss the hypothesis as irrational. But public health officials have been saying they know. They've been implying to the public there's enough evidence, and they know it's not causal. I think they can't say that. You can't say that, unquote. So contrary to the British Medical Journal, wanting to think anyone who's critical of vaccines and of any type, in any combination, and adverse effects, that they're flat earthers, and they're just mere skeptics, well, there's one of the people who would disagree with you. And CBS News, exclusive, leading doctor, vaccines, autism, word study, former head of the National Institute of Health, said government too quick to dismiss public link. By the way, Dr. Healy is a Harvard and Johns Hopkins educated physician, cardiologist, and former head of the National Institutes of Health, and a professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, professor and dean of the College of Medicine and Public Health at Ohio State University, and served as president of the American Red Cross. And the large increases in autistic conditions cannot be caused by genetics was confirmed by Dr. Francis Collins, the current director of a major agency and the U.S. National Institutes of Health, and a leading medical doctor and geneticist who led the Human Genome Project. And when director of the U.S. National Human Genome Project and Institute, Collins confirmed in public to the U.S. House of Representatives in May 2006 that recent increases in chronic diseases like diabetes and childhood asthma, obesity, and autism must have an environmental, external cause and cannot be purely genetically or internally caused. Quote, recent increases in chronic diseases like diabetes, childhood asthma, obesity, or autism cannot be due to major shifts in the human gene pool, as those changes take much more time to occur. They must be due to changes in the environment, including diet and physical activity, which may produce disease in genetically predisposed persons. Therefore, GEI will also invest in innovative new technology sensors to measure environmental toxins, dietary intake, and physical activity, and using new tools of genomics, proteomics, and understanding metabolism rates to determine an individual's biological response to these influences, unquote. And he's an MD, PhD, testifying before the House of Representatives Committee. Now, the U.S. federal court has found in three cases made public that vaccines can cause autistic conditions in children. Brief summaries. Hannah Poling, the U.S. District, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, settled the U.S. federal court claims of this 9-year-old child in a sealed secret settlement in 2008, and that the experts conceded in that case that without a hearing, claiming her mitochondrial dysfunction was rare. Recent research shows that mitochondrial dysfunction is not rare, but common in autistic children compared to non-autistic children. And Hannah Poling developed an autistic condition after being administered 9 vaccines in one day. Now, her father, John, is a medical doctor at Johns Hopkins University, and her mother is a former nurse. Court awards over $20 million, and that was that. Now, then you have Bailey Banks. Autistic conditions can result from acute disseminated encephalomyelitis following MMR vaccine. As held by the U.S. federal court in the case of Bailey Banks, the British Health Ministry misled the English Parliament when she claimed in a written parliamentary answer that Bailey Banks did not have an autistic condition. Quite simply, she was wrong, and she should be held accountable to apologize. Why was she wrong? It could not have been because she was not informed of the truth. And therefore, a special investigation should be put into place to challenge the British Health Minister. And in fact, Bailey Banks developed PDD and NOC, which is an autistic condition, following his MMR vaccine. Bailey Banks' diagnosis follows U.S. terminologies under DSM-4 for what is called, in the rest of the world, autistic spectrum disorder, under International Classification of Disease. And that was Banks versus the HHS, case 020738V, 2007 U.S. Claims, Lexis 254, July 20, 2007. In his conclusion, U.S. Federal Court Special Master Abel ruled that petitioners had proven that the MMR had directly caused a brain inflammation illness called acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, or ADEM, which in turn has caused the autism spectrum disorder PDD-NOS in the child. The court found that Bailey's condition was both caused in fact and proximately caused by his vaccination. It is well understood that the vaccination at issue can cause that same condition. The court found, based upon a full reading and hearing of the pertinent facts in this case, that it did actually cause the condition. Furthermore, Bailey's ADEM was severe enough to cause lasting residual damage and retarded his developmental progress, which fits under the generalized heading of pervasive developmental delay, or PDD. And note that that's an autism spectrum disorder. The court found that Bailey would not have suffered this delay but for the administration of the MMR vaccine, and that this chain of causation was a proximate sequence of cause and effect leading inexorably to the pervasive development disorder. And that is Bank versus the HHS, case 02073V. But here's what the British Health Minister, Don Primolaro, stated in the English Parliament. Quote, Ms. Primolaro claimed Bailey Banks, whose autistic condition was caused by vaccines and had won his case in the U.S. federal court on that basis, was not diagnosed with autism. In fact, the minister is also reported to have been sending out the same information in written replies to inquiries from British MPs made on behalf of constituents. The written answer, MMR vaccine, appears in the Hansard, the official record of proceedings in the English Parliament, on March 18, 2009, column 1229W. The full text of the exchange from Hansard on the MMR vaccine, quote, from Mark Pritchard, to ask the Secretary of State of Health if he will make an assessment of the implications of the decision in the U.S. court of Bailey Banks versus Secretary of Department of Health and Human Services for his department's policy on the MMR vaccine, reference 263933, Don Primamarillo. In 2007, the U.S. Court of Federal Claims made a ruling in favor of compensation to the father of Bailey Banks for his non-autistic developmental delay as a result of acute disseminated encephalomyelitis following receipt of measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. This is an extremely rare condition that has been reported after rabies, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, smallpox, MMR, Japanese B encephalitis, pertussis, influenza, and hepatitis B vaccines. The Bailey case has no implications for the MMR vaccine policy. Absolutely wrong. And this person should be held accountable for dispensing misinformation. The British media should be all over this. And then finally, Ben Zeller. In the U.S. federal court case of Ben Zeller, this boy was proven to have suffered a developmental delay caused by vaccines. The judgment records that the defendant, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, had no alternative explanation beyond unconfirmed speculation by a few treating doctors, as with Dr. Zitzneiser hypothesizing. So what we have is we have a lot of evidence that Mr. Deere claimed did not exist. And I've saved it for today to give you, citing the actual statistics, the relevant documents, and the statements. All it takes is one. Now, how many children in the United States? I have interviewed so many parents. In one meeting, I interviewed more than 400 in Chicago, where we spent several days filming a documentary that was Vaccine Nation. And one after the other said, including physicians, my child was normal until the vaccines, and then they went into this very dark place known as autism spectrum disorder. Are we to believe that all these hundreds of thousands of parents are wrong? Are we to believe that they are not the persons who should be trusted in the development of their children? Are we to believe the journalists who say there is no connection? The physicians saying there's no connection. Official agencies and the media complicit saying there's no connection. That is why we have done this extensive study and this program. I'm Gary Nall. We are now going to go to our panelists for final statements. And then whatever time is left, I will turn over to our audience to be able to call in. So you now have an open forum. You will call. You'll be able to call and let me give you our number. It is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. This is a four-hour radio special. That is one of the longest radio specials you will ever hear in the United States. I thank all of the thousands who are still on board and for listening in. Let us now go back through our panelists and speak with each one to get their final comment on anything they would like to add to this program today. Isabella Thomas. Isabella, your final thoughts, please.
Thoughts are that this is the biggest crime in history to children. And, you know, I'd say to any parent out there who has got a vaccine-damaged child, you know, hold your head up high and fight for justice. You know, don't be frightened of anything. Fight for justice. It would be a good idea if we could all get together and if parents could post what's happened to their children. I'm sure, you know, if we can all get together as one force, then we'd have parent power in this. And I'm telling you now, if we have parent power from every parent all over the world who's got a vaccine-damaged child, we would make changes. Because nobody harms our children and gets away with it.
Well, they
and
have,
that's my final thought.
Okay, they have gotten away with it, and that's why we're concerned that they no longer can get away with it. Now, here's my suggestion. I am willing to use my website and my Facebook for an open forum for all parents. In fact, I'm going to let my audience know that I only am going to allow people on my Facebook who have something relevant to share. I opened up my Facebook not to have people tell me what they had for breakfast or what they're doing tomorrow, but relevance, a consumer, activist, a really conscientious group of people. And so if you go to Gary Knoll and Gary Knoll's Facebook and come on there, that way thousands, hundreds of thousands of people can communicate one with another and share videos and stories, and that's where you have coalescing. Right now, and here's one of the problems, Isabella, right now in the United States, there are many, many different vaccine advocacy groups. The problem is that there are not a lot of communication, even autism groups. Some people don't believe autism is due to vaccines or is not due to mercury. Others believe it is. Some don't want the alternative approaches. Some do. Some people in the autism and vaccine movement have actually aligned themselves and are getting money from the very pharmaceutical companies whose vaccines could be causing the damage. And therefore, they try to give a different pro-industry, pro-vaccine point of view and look for other environmental factors that might have caused it and deny the complicity of the vaccine. So not everyone speaks with the same word. There's no unity, and we need that, and we need to have one place where people who believe that the vaccines are a major but not exclusive contributing factor, and also the treatments. One of the people who had autism, who's completely normal today, is one of the people I work with. The name is Jonathan Ortega. Jonathan Ortega's parents are two New York City police officers in Brooklyn. And when they came to me, their child was on four major tranquilizers and told they would have to have a fifth. Otherwise, he was too large to keep at home, and they had to be with him 24/7. With no insurance, it was bankrupting them. And also, he was becoming out of control, and they were afraid they were going to have put him in an autism home, and those are terrible. They're like a medical gulag. They keep them medicated for the rest of their life, so they're sedated so they don't act out. I went to work on them, and today he's completely normal. He's in a normal school, doing very well. He's developing. He's catching up. He has complete communication and with his parents, his friends. And when you have cases like this, and he's not the only one, there are many by different, many different healing systems that will work, there's got to be a way to communicate, to bring that information together. So there was the Dan, but the Dans are not the only people. There are dozens. There's Dr. Yurkowski. He has systems. There are many different approaches. You should pull that together. That's what made Dr. Joseph Issel so important. He used many different approaches, not just one. And we don't have that today in vaccines. We don't have it in autism. If we did, we'd be making giant steps forward. So thank you very much for that suggestion, Isabella Thompson. Let's hope it happens. Now let's,
it's Thomas.
Thomas, yes. Now let's go over and say hello to our next panelist who is standing by, and that would be Jim Moody. Jim, your final thoughts for us, please.
Yes, Gary, thank you for your thorough investigation, as always. My final thoughts are, one, we know vaccines can cause autism. We have to get to the bottom of how many kids are affected and what the mechanism of injury is, and to take steps to make the vaccine schedule or other environmental toxins safer. We owe that to our children as a matter of moral, legal, and ethical duty. Two, the research that must be funded, must be the good science that must be done, is to compare unvaccinated to vaccinated children so we can get a handle on not only how much autism, but asthma, JRA, diabetes, ADHD, every other kind of chronic illness that may be caused by vaccine, again, with the goal of making the vaccine schedule safer. Three, we must protect, as a human right, the right, the choice to take vaccines or not. They cannot be and should not be compelled by society. For any reason, it should be always an individual citizen's or parent's choice to use those vaccines as a matter of basic medical ethics and civil rights. And thank you again.
Jim, thank you and your group for all the good work you're doing for the National Autism Association, for Safe Minds, and because they're out there offering a forum for people to communicate and share their concerns, and you as a representative of those people who are going before the courts and helping steer them into the vaccine courts. We need a lot of change and reform in that system so more parents will be able to use it and more children would be given compensation. Thank you. Let's say hello to Clifford Miller. Clifford Miller, final thoughts, please.
Yeah, Gary, basically, in relation to the General Medical Council and Andrew Wakefield, we need someone to look really, really hard at the chairman of panels, Harvey Markovich, who chooses the panels and then writes an editorial in the British Medical Journal claiming that someone, Dr. Walker Smith, who's appealing one of his panel decisions, claiming he's effectively a fraud, because by accusing Andrew Wakefield of fraud, he's accusing Professor Walker Smith of fraud. And that is when an appeal is pending to the English High Court against one of his own panel decisions. And we have to again ask the question, what does the chairman of the panels do when the original panel chairman in the Wakefield trial at the General Medical Council was going to be Professor Dennis McDevitt, who sat on a safety committee that was meant to be looking into the safety of a dangerous MMR vaccine, which had to be withdrawn in 1992 because it was known to be dangerous. And yet he sat on the safety committee, and they were going to put him on the hearing as to chair the hearing into Andrew Wakefield. But hang on. Okay, they only took him off after half a dozen journalists started asking questions and they got embarrassed. And who do they put in this place? Dr. Surendra Kumar. And what's wrong with Surendra Kumar? 2 months after it's all over, he announces to the world that we must compulsorily vaccinate all children, which is a position that the chairman of the British Medical Association, Hamish Meldrum, had described as Stalinist and as medically and ethically dubious. That alone debars or would have debarred Surendra Kumar for even sitting on that panel. Under the Nolan principles, he would have had to declare that. He breached several of them, and he shouldn't have been the panel chairman. And I'm not going to comment on the individual expert witnesses that were brought against these three doctors in the General Medical Council, because Jim Moody filed a complaint with the General Medical Council about certain aspects of their evidence. But I'll give the example of a case in which I acted, and for my client, who was put through a three-week ordeal, not a 200-and-odd-day ordeal, had a three-week ordeal. The quality of the expert witness against her, he was trashed in cross-examination and eventually had to admit that his lengthy, lengthy report designed to wipe out my client and get her erased from the medical register was, quote, quibbling. That's the quality of expert witnesses that the GMC prosecution put up, and they think they can get away with it. And with my client, they certainly didn't. We mounted a thorough, careful, scientific and medical case and demonstrated and destroyed their case. And they thought they could get away with it because they thought my client would not be able to get the representation to do that. And that's the quality. That's what I've got to say about the GMC. Well, one final thought. The General Medical Council, these are the people who gave advice to general practitioner doctors in the UK that it was okay to commit fraud to get their vaccine bonuses by taking patients off the register temporarily at the end of the period so that they could say they had a 100% vaccination record and then put them back on when the period was over. That is the General Medical Council.
So what you're saying is the General Medical Council panel chairman, Dr. Harvey Markowitz, who accused Wakefield in the British Medical Journal, and with him by implication the entire team of fraud, when there is currently a pending appeal before the English High Court, Markowitz chooses the panels and their chairman. And the original panel chairman was Professor McDevitt. Who was taken off when the British press asked questions. And he sat on a government vaccine safety committee, which failed to deal adequately with safety issues over the dangerous Plucerec MMR vaccine, which was 3 years later taken off the market. And the General Medical Council panel chairman, who heard the GMC case, breached the Nolan principles, which would have debarred him from taking part. He failed to disclose his extreme view of compulsory MMR 2 months after the final verdict, a view described by the British Medical Association chairman Hamish Meldrum as, quote, Stalinist and medically and ethically dubious. And also, Markowitz is linked to the ABPI, owned and funded by Medico Legal Investigations, who assisted Brian Deere in 2003 and 4 with advice. They specialize investigations to get medical doctors before the General Medical Council to get them disbarred, showing that it was what was planned from the beginning. And there are questions over the reliability of the GMC's witnesses. And so that is what you're saying. Final question for you that is important for many of us. At any time, are you aware, from your own investigation, did Brian Deere ever consult with or was helped in any way by members of any pharmaceutical industry or foundation or front group or specialist from any pharmaceutical or pro-vaccine group?
The only organization that he was provided assistance with was Medico Legal Investigations, who gave him advice. They specialize in getting doctors in front of the General Medical Council, and they gave him advice before he published his stories in the Sunday Times about Andrew Wakefield. And that shows that Brian Deere had in mind getting Andrew Wakefield before the General Medical Council, before he wrote a single word. And he was hired by the Sunday Times to get a big story just before the High Court in England was going to hear a case as to whether their legal funding should continue. And the judge who heard that case, Judge Nigel Davis, happens to be the brother of Sir Crispin Davis. Who's he? Oh, he's only the CEO of the company that owns The Lancet. And hey presto, 2 months before Brian Deere was hired, Sir Crispin Davis was hired onto the GlaxoSmithKline board, one of the defendants in the MMR litigation. Now, have you got a peg on your nose, Gary? Because you're going to need it.
That's substantial. Thank you very much, Clifford Miller, for your participation.
Welcome.
Now let's go over and say hello to Dr. Edward Yazbek. Dr. Yazbek, final thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Null. Well, there is no question that our lies and false accusations on the pages of the BMJ lately, thanks to Mr. Deere. But there are also bigger lies that were told against Dr. Wakefield, and I think must have hurt him even more, is when medical authorities said that because of him, vaccination rates were down, measles is going to spread all over the country, and kids are going to die. It must have broken his heart because his whole work was to save kids. And this was absolutely not true. Dr. Wakefield had told them beforehand, before he published the paper, please make sure you have enough single vaccines so that you can protect everybody in case people stop using the MMR. Not only did the health department not have enough single vaccines, they went ahead and removed the license. They de-licensed the vaccine, the single vaccines that were available, so that they forced the people to have a choice between MMR or nothing. And so if they could not go to France to get expensive vaccines, if they could not find an expensive clinic in England to get a vaccine, and if they were afraid from further kids to take the MMR vaccine, they had no choice but not to vaccinate them. It was not Dr. Wakefield that created that problem. It was the medical authorities that de-licensed the vaccines and who did not listen to him.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Edward Yazbek, board-certified pediatrician and former clinical director of the Charles Chapin Hospital and Institute of Health and Science at Brown University, and author of papers, etc. Dr. Andrew Wakefield, since this has been the longest investigative reporting radio broadcast in my history, 4 hours, I thought we would close out with your comments, please.
Guy, thank you very much, and thank you very much to all the people on the panel. In fact, all of them are known to me and good friends. It's been a long, hard battle, but we will continue and we will win. And the polls show that the people are with us, that they are concerned, and that the science is not in. And until that science is done, to the satisfaction of the American people who won't be hoodwinked, then we're going to continue to have this problem. And so the issue of the ad hominem attacks and the name-calling has got to stop. It's fruitless. In fact, it's entirely negative from the perspective of the other side, and we need to get on with the job at hand. I think that my hope is at the end of the day what this does is to reinforce the fundamental rules of clinical medicine is that you take a proper history and you listen to the patient or the patient's parents, and they will provide you with the answer. And what is the legacy of my experience in this is that that is exactly what has happened. The parents have been right all along. They've driven the science, medicine, and the scientific community have dragged their feet and have not only been an obstacle to progress, but have actually been a negative force that has impeded progress. And that is a great shame. That needs to stop. And for the sake of the children, we need to resolve this issue right now.
Well, similar to an earlier clip from the program where there was a gentleman spending life in prison without the benefit of parole until I looked carefully, and it didn't make sense what I saw. And it took a long time before we got him a new trial, but eventually he walked out of prison a free person. He walked out of that courtroom, and then suddenly all the media showed up. NBC, Fox, everybody wanted to know what had happened. How did it happen? But no one was there for those 7 years when we were putting together the pieces, deconstructing the lies against him, and to make him a free man. It is my belief that based upon a careful, meticulous, and scholarly review of all the allegations and charges against you, since I do not know you, I've never met you in person, we're not friends, I could be objective, as I am, and it is my belief at this moment that the day will come when you will be a free man and get your license back, and then the media will have to say, gee whiz, how did we miss it? And I'm saying, become real journalists again. Look for the truth and look beyond ideologies, politics, look beyond fear. And you will see the truth. So, Andrew Wakefield, thank you very much. We look forward to continuing in our efforts.
Thank you very much, Ken.
I promised some listeners our whole board is filled, but we're running out of time, and I do have to end within 2 minutes. But I'll say hello to Marriott from New York. Hi, Marriott.
Hello. I think you mean Lorette.
Lorette
from New York. When you're looking at an incidence of 1% of the population having autism, it's also important to look at populations that have higher incidences. And I adopted a child with Down syndrome, and Down syndrome children have about 10% comorbidity with autism. And it's important for you to understand that all of them have mitochondrial dysfunction from in utero. This has been shown. They all have dysregulated immune systems. They all are under oxidative stress since in utero. And it amazes me that they won't look at a population of children that has such a dramatically higher incidence to see what's unique about that population of children. My child went down after the MMR, and she was not 18 months old. She was over 3 years of age when that happened, and yet they're still saying that it's coincidental. I can see where at 18 months they say, well, that's the time you'd have gone down anyway, and you just coincidentally got the vaccine, but we just coincidentally didn't get it until age 3, and that's when she became autistic. So just a comment, and thank you so much. You've done the most phenomenal interviews, and I'm really sorry that Dr. Wakefield had to go through what he goes through, but we love him, and the parents are behind him. Thank you.
We're out of time. Thank you all very much for taking your time today to listen, and for the thousands from all over the world. This is not the end of this. This is just the next step. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day.
Far too many of you died. You know we have to find a way to bring some loving here today.
The Gary Nall Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee. Don't punish me with brutality.